Good morning, everyone. I'm Richard Rogers from Carpinteria, and I'm president of the Fish and Game Commission. Welcome to the second day of the Fish and Game Commission's December meeting. Sitting on the other side of the guy to my left is Vice President of the Commission, Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City. Sitting to her left is Dan Richards from Upland, Commissioner Richards, and sitting to his left is Commissioner Kellogg from Concord. And immediately to my left is John Carlson, Executive Director, Deputy Executive Director, Adriana Shea over on the far end. Deputy Executive Director John Fisher is sitting over here. Let's see, from the department, we have Sonky Mastrup. Everyone else has fled the building, apparently. Eric Loft is out there. Maria Vojkovich is, I believe, here. At least she was here. Let's see, who all do we have? Sherry Fonbuena is sitting right here. I'm just going through. Deborah Barnes, of course, our Attorney General. And Anita Biederman is hiding around the corner from me, so I can just see her. So I think that's it, except for Captain Brian Naslin in the back. And I don't see any of the other wardens. I think that'll all infill a little bit later. So, John, take it away.
Thank you. For some housekeeping, if you're interested in speaking on any agenda items, there's green speaker cards at the back of the room. Please turn those in to staff. We have a aggregate of 10 minutes for speaking per person during the day. So if you want to speak on several items, please make sure that you choose wisely. Also want to remind everyone that we are live videotaped and live feed over the internet right now. And then the meetings are archived. Available through our website, linked to the AGP video website. And that's a free service, so if you ever want to look at what has happened at previous meetings, that is all available through the web and indexed by our, recently it's indexed by our agenda. We also ask that everyone, if you have a comment to make, put your card in and speak at the microphone. We, for courteousness and keep the meeting orderly, we would like people not to be commenting from their seats or catcalling or disturbing the rest of the audience. With that, we're going to start off with a carryover from yesterday, and that is the ALDS update, automatic licensing database update. Deputy Director Sonky Mastrup is the lucky guy that gets to give that update today.
With pleasure. Good morning, Commissioners. There's some good news on this front. I don't know if it'll totally satisfy everyone, but it is progress in the right direction. As you know, the state's been struggling with this tech project, but we have some updates.
You realize that's a redundant statement.
Yes. It's a challenge. The good news is the director appointed a new chief deputy as the executive sponsor, as you know, Mr. McCammon. And we have a new state chief information officer that reviewed the new approach. The state office of CIO interviewed and basically stopped all the work on the project and reviewed it and gave us some feedback, and we restarted the project. We implemented the new directives from that state review. We reorganized, got IT more involved in the project. We have a new technical project manager. We did update the project schedule, and we've also increased our independent oversight and review of the project, so we have a third party really helping us scrutinize the project with a lot more experience in these things than we may have. You know, there's been some, you may have heard there have been some changes in the contractor we're working with. They were acquired, or Outdoor Central, who was the group we started with, was acquired by Active Network on October 30th. They're the ones that, they're a huge organization. They do a lot of the reservation systems like state parks and everything. So they have extensive countrywide experience in doing these operations and bring to it a lot more resources. So Active Network has improved communications with the department and the state. They've assigned a new executive management team to the project to ensure a little more direct oversight. And they've added significant new staff resources to our project. So that's all very encouraging, and they're taking our concerns about lack of progress very seriously. Update on the project schedule. We're at this point, phase one, the deployment of point of sale is still on for early 2011. But we have, the good news is that we actually have what we're calling a internet bridge sub-project, which is to introduce some features before 2011. And the focus will be to provide internet licensing sales as a bridge to full ALDS implementation. And what that will be is the scope of this bridge is to provide sport fishing license items only. Because of hunter ed verification, we can't do hunting. But we'll be selling sport fishing licenses, all resident and non-resident, annual and short-term fishing licenses with some of the privileges. We won't be doing report cards like the abalone report card because of the physical nature of those report cards, but everything else. And so what we'll be doing with this bridge, we'll be able to sell 95% of all sport fishing items sold and 60% of all items the department sells. So just with this internet bridge, we will capture and make available the bulk of all our sale items to the public through the internet. And that also amounts to 98% of all our sport fishing revenues will be generated through that based on current figures, and 70% of our total revenues. So this bridge will accommodate the bulk of that. And it has the potential to provide a service to about 2.3 million customers. Pardon?
When?
Oh, I was saving that for last. You're getting ahead of me here. First, a little more few features of this nifty new bridge is that the main feature will be it'll allow you to go online, buy your temporary license or your 1 or 2 day license, print it at home. A key feature there, until this January, it wouldn't be legal to do that. We had to fix some statute to make a print at home license valid. That law doesn't go into effect until January, so the timing's perfect here to implement that.
And it has a barcode. Is that how we do it?
Yes. It'll be a unique barcode. So when you print it out, kind of like your boarding pass or your ticket sales, there'll be a unique barcode. So the warden, in theory, could check it and make sure it's actually valid, not just a fancy scam. You'll also be able to buy your regular fishing license, but obviously, a paper-printed thing won't work, so it'll be a temporary, and it'll automatically trigger a mailing of the permanent fishing license for the year. So there'll be some mail fulfillment of some of the things. Active will assume all the costs for the process, and in return, they'll fund their efforts through the they'll basically become a license agent and get their 5% handling fee that all license agents get. So that's how it'll be funded for them. And then DFG and Active will manage and develop independently from ALDS this piece of it. So it's literally a bridge to satisfy the bulk of the unit sales while we wrap up all the more complicated pieces of this. So the next steps are to finalize requirements and agreements with Active. This is our plan. Develop a specific implementation plan and launch the project and also begin stakeholder outreach. And I know how I'm hesitant to give a date, but Active has assured us this should be operational this in 09. So when in 09, it's not clear until we see the final implementation, but they're pretty confident they can do it very quickly. So any questions?
That is good news. Any comments or questions?
I have several. You said there's a outside third party assisting and participating in that process of creating all this. Who is that?
I don't know the person's name. They've been hired by the other office as an independent expert consultant.
And so they're a technology consultant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm interested in this, as you know, and I think everybody is, but I'm interested in it. I haven't seen any of this. And so I want to know what the commission's role is in the implementation and creation of this, actually not the implementation, the creation of this. Because I'm concerned you may be going down paths where we want more or less, and we're not seeing any of that. We're not a participant in this process.
Yeah, just so I'll share with you, the commission and department's interactions on this project to date has been we've asked and gotten feedback from the commission on what kind of features and services that the commission would like to see with this service, and then we've taken those expectations and tried to build them into the product. So bottom line is you tell us what you want to see.
And what might be appropriate, Santi, yeah. to bring, because Dan is relatively new, and Dan needs an update, obviously.
Yeah, I'd even like more than an update, candidly. I'd like to be a little more involved in this process right now, because what I don't want to see is you go down a path here, creation of a process that ultimately is not what the sporting community is really looking for. I'm not saying you're doing that, by the way, under any circumstance. Right. I'm saying I don't know that. And when I hear a third party, you know, like, it would seem to me this would be an absolutely perfect venue to bring to someone like the Tauscher Committee and say, this is what we're thinking about. This is kind of where we're going. And to get the feedback from them to say, what about XYZ and, you know, whatever. For instance, I know that we're not talking about the joint hunting and fishing license, but there is a world of people that think that's a good idea, and we have to make some changes to some things. But it just seems like we're just going to get something that someone spent a whole lot of time on that's not quite enough input from us on this process right now, and I'd like to get more involved in that.
Jim, did you?
Just so for Dan's benefit, we have bartered this thing back and forth for a few years now.
I know.
And it's been before the Tauscher Committee, like you're talking about, and they have heeded all the suggestions that the commission and the Tauscher Committee has brought forth so far. I understand what you're saying.
We didn't talk about it at the last meeting. It wasn't an agenda item.
Yeah. But, I mean, I hear where you're coming. I just want you to know that they have not bypassed the
I'm not saying there are, but I'm saying we're at a point right now. This is a new group, every, you know, bigger outfit, blah, 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 going to do all these things. And it's like, whoa, let's make sure that we're in the loop here too, versus this just powering ahead from two-year-old information from people who aren't here anymore. And I like to make sure it's all.
I completely understand. What I would recommend is that what you and I can work together, or your staff, we should probably schedule a briefing meeting for you to bring you up to speed, and then we can also talk about bringing some for the Al Toucher. I mean,
actually, I think that's where I'd like to have the briefing.
All right, we can certainly plan on coming to the next Al Toucher and giving you the full rundown where we've been.
Yeah, the full rundown, so that we can see what they're going to look like, what the timing is, what all's on them, so that group can then.
Okay, Dan.
Buy-in, because they're critical for buy-in.
I think that is the consensus of the commissioners, at least sitting here. So, yes, that's good.
Yeah, we'll arrange
Thank
that.
Thank you, Sankey, for that suggestion. That's a good suggestion. Late January. What was it? You had a potential date. It was 22?
Yeah, the next meeting is January 29th.
29.
Sacram.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's right.
Just as this is a point of clarification, so there's no anxiety. The technical consultant is not providing guidance on the actual services. It's mostly just on reviewing whether the company can deliver what we're asking it to do. More of the technical side, not on the characteristics of the program. But we'll brief you all that.
Right, and that's what, candidly, I'm more focused on is the characteristics. You're going to have to make sure it gets implemented.
Yes.
But I just want to make sure that we do, you know, get started on the right foot instead of hiccup out of the chute. It's taken so long. It looks like maybe we're close enough to engage one time here.
We'll look forward to bringing you up to speed. As Commissioner Kellogg, that we've been talking about this quite a few years.
This is very good news, Sankey.
Yes.
I'm glad to be hearing what I'm hearing today.
This is, I'm actually hopeful that we are going to see something in our lifetimes.
Well,
that's why I made that comment yesterday about when that guy said if and when. I said, don't worry.
Well, while we're young, Sankey, while we're young. Okay, thank you. John?
Thank you. That moves us to item 9, announcement of results from executive session.
Deborah?
Good morning, Commissioners. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General, and there are no announcements from the executive session of December 11th.
I have one public speaker card for number 9. Okay, he declines. Moving to item number 10, update and possible action on Pacific Fisher petition findings as related to the November 6th, 2008 correspondence from petitioners. And I'm going to turn that over to Deb Barnes, our Assistant Attorney General.
Good morning again. The Pacific Fisher, if you'll, the commission will recall, you made a decision on in your August 2008 meeting on a petition to begin the candidate review period that was submitted by the Center for Biological Diversity. The commission voted to deny that petition. This is in conjunction with a case that's been pending through the appellate courts on the commission's decision not to accept the California tiger salamander for that same candidacy period. Because of the status of the California tiger salamander case, shortly after the commission made its decision on Pacific Fisher in August, approximately 2 to 3 days later, the Court of Appeal rendered a decision on the California tiger salamander that is basically the second major appellate decision in regarding the California Endangered Species Act. And there's been a lot of discussions back and forth as to exactly what that case means, how it may or may not impact the commission's decision-making process regarding the acceptance of species for candidate purposes. And as a result, the Attorney General's office filed a petition for review with the California Supreme Court shortly after the September meeting of the commission. Because that case, the petition for review is pending, the commission has waited to see what the status of the law would be and has not to date adopted findings that is consistent with that August 2008 decision. Prior to December 10th, the California Supreme Court had informed all the parties that they were going to make a decision by January 12th. And lo and behold, they acted a lot more quickly than some other courts do and rendered a decision late on December 10th. We found out late December 10th that the California Supreme Court declined to review the appellate court's decision in California tiger salamander. And we got word of that late Wednesday evening before your meeting on December 11th. Because of that, it puts the California tiger salamander matter is now the law of certainly the Third District Court of Appeal in California. And I think it's from the amount of correspondence we've received both from the petitioners and from other interested parties, the decision certainly is subject to a lot of views on both sides of that issue. So there is a suggested staff motion so that the commission can receive a full analysis of the impact, if any, of California tiger salamander on your decision-making processes under the California Endangered Species Act.
Thank you, Deborah.
We have four speaker cards, commissioners. Please keep your comments to within 3 minutes. Justin Augustine, David Moser, Chris Carr, and Walt Manziel.
I might mention that Chief Nancy Foley, Deputy Director Nancy Foley, Chief of Enforcement, has arrived in the auditorium as well. That was not Nancy just then.
And if the other speakers could line up against the wall so we can move orderly, I'd appreciate it.
You know, our little speaker probably needs to put a speaker card in, too, because I think we're probably going to get continuous comment from our little
man. All right. I'm Justin Augustine, Center for Biological Diversity. As we just heard, Supreme Court declined to hear Center for Biological Diversity versus Fish and Game Commission, so the appellate decision is now final. And I'd just like to reemphasize that that appellate decision reiterates that we, the petitioners, only need to convince an objective, reasonable person that listing may be warranted. When you all voted in August, I don't think you were aware that the majority of department biologists who were evaluating the petition found in favor of that petition. I know the commission declined to accept the California tiger salamander petition, despite the fact that in that case as well, virtually every biologist supported the petition. I hope, though, in light of the Supreme Court denial of cert, that at this point in time, we all recognize that the reasonable person standard is not a high bar, and that therefore, the very fact that most of your department biologists who are evaluating the petition found that a status review is necessary is, well, it's very meaningful. It's exceptionally meaningful. So the only other point I'm going to make is pretty much restating the obvious. All the petition is asking for is a status review. A status review is going to give you the answers that you want, I think. And I think you've all now read the statements from your own biologists pointing out why a status review is necessary, and I'll just read one of them. One of your biologists stated, "When I look at the body of published information available, combined with the level of activity underway directed at conserving and recovering the fissure, the weight of evidence is more than adequate to make the call that the petitioned action, may be warranted. It's certainly more than we've had for similar calls that were made before for other species, like the California tiger salamander and tricolored blackbirds. That is the only call we are charged with making now, even though there is pressure to complete the bulk of what would normally be done in a status review." So, long story short, there is not one good reason to force the fisher to go through what this California tiger salamander had to go through just to get a status review. I think you all know that, I know that, and I hope we'll all move on to a status review. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
David Moser, followed by Chris Carr, Walt Manziel.
Good morning. My name is David Moser. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Eben Moser & Skaggs in San Francisco, and I'm here this morning on behalf of Green Diamond Resource Company. Also here today from Green Diamond is Gary Reinierson. Green Diamond owns and manages approximately 440,000 acres of timberlands in the North Coast region of California, and has long worked very closely with state and federal resource agencies to conserve threatened and endangered species and sensitive habitats on its lands. As part of those stewardship efforts, Green Diamond has conducted numerous extensive studies of the fisher on its lands since the early 1990s. And as a result, Green Diamond has been keenly interested in the fisher petition process and has participated extensively throughout. Green Diamond submitted three sets of comments to the department during the department's review of the petition, made a presentation at the department stakeholder meeting about its research and the findings of that research, and Green Diamond also participated and presented testimony at the commission's meeting in August. As you know, on October 1st, I submitted on behalf of Green Diamond a letter to the commission detailing why, in our view, the Court of Appeals decision in the tiger salamander case does not alter the commission's decision on the fisher petition. And now, with the Supreme Court having denied the commission's petition for review in that case, in our view, that clears the way, certainly, for the commission to now prepare and adopt findings at its next meeting on the fisher petition decision. Towards that end, we recommend that the commission take the following specific steps. First, you should, as no doubt is already underway, evaluate whether the Court of Appeals decision in the CTS case requires that you reach a different result, and you should clearly conclude that it does not, and here's why. The CTS decision did not change the legal test which the Commission must apply in evaluating a CESA petition. The Court of Appeals and the CTS made clear that the test, the substantial possibility test, remains just as announced by the Court of Appeals in 1994, and which you have applied routinely in all CESA petitions since that time. What the Court of Appeals decision in the CTS case did do was scrutinize how the commission applied that test to a particular data set for the CTS, a data set that could not be more different than the data set that exists for the Fisher. For the CTS, there was no historic population or range information. In contrast, there is extensive both historic and current population and range data for the Fisher. For the CTS, the department recommended twice that the petition be granted. In this case, the department concluded that the petition should be rejected. In evaluating the petition, the code requires that you consider the petition and submitted comments and apply the substantial information, sufficient information test. As that applies to how the code defines what a threatened or endangered species is. So in sum, the test is whether the petition and associated information contains the amount of information that would lead a reasonable person to conclude that there is a substantial possibility that the species is in serious danger, either now or in the foreseeable future, of becoming extinct throughout all or significant portion of its range. Since the data set, the record in this case, demonstrates clearly that the population and the range of the Fisher has not changed in the last 80 years, is stable, and there are no current or forecasted threats to the population and range of the Fisher, there is no possibility that a reasonable person could conclude that the Fisher is in danger of going extinct now or in the foreseeable future. Second, we recommend that as you evaluate the Court of Appeals decision and its impacts on Fisher, that you also review not only the request for reconsideration, which you received from the petitioners in October, which attached a number of documents that the prior speaker mentioned, but also the entire record that was produced to the petitioners as a result of their Public Records Act request. We understand that the California Forestry Association has submitted that entire record to you this week. Third, we recommend that at your next open meeting, when presumably you will adopt findings, that you announce in open session your conclusions about the impacts, if any, of the Court of Appeals decision and your review of the record. And finally, in your written findings themselves, we certainly recommend that you explicitly address the Court of Appeals decision, which is now the applicable law on this matter, and that you address your review of the entire factual record produced by the department. And, of course, explain the reasons why you continue to find that the Fisher petition is not sufficient and should be rejected. We greatly appreciate your thoughtful consideration of the petition and these ever-evolving legal issues associated with it, and look forward to seeing your findings at the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Mosher. Are there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
Thank you.
Chris Carr, Walt Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Carr on behalf of the California Forestry Association. I've made about a dozen copies of a detailed letter that I submitted to the commission late yesterday addressing the implications of the finality of the CTS decision for the commission's decision on the Fisher. I'll provide those. And I've also, as Mr. Moser indicated, on behalf of the California Forestry Association, I submitted to the commission earlier this week the full 2,300-page production of the department in response to CBD CPRA request. The attachments of CBD to its October letter, some of those attachments were referenced by the first speaker, really only cherry-picked from that record, and we believe it's appropriate for the commission to have the full CPRA production of the department in front of it, and I'll provide those CDs as well. They've already been forwarded in CD form to the executive director. I agree entirely with the comments made by Mr. Moser. I won't rehash those. The Fisher facts, as found by the commission in August, could not be more different from the facts that pertained in the case of the CTS. Just briefly, there is solid population abundance and range information for the Fisher. Habitat loss does not have to be used as a proxy to gauge population. Indeed, in the case of the Fisher, happily, the alleged habitat loss, according to CBD, has turned out not to be habitat loss at all, that is loss of old growth forests, because data and studies show quite clearly that Fisher use intensively managed second growth forests. So there really hasn't been any habitat loss at all. And then third, the historic threats to the Fisher have all been eliminated. So there is no basis for thinking that the any reasonable person could conclude that the Fisher is in danger of extinction now or in the foreseeable future. So really, the commission should focus on the specific facts of the Fisher case. CFA's position is not that the CTS decision doesn't somehow apply or should not inform the commission's decision. However, it does not dictate a contrary result from the result reached by the commission at its August meeting. As explained in detail in my letter, the CTS decision is really an outlier. But again, that doesn't mean it's not the law. What it means is the facts as found by the Court of Appeal in the CTS decision are unusual and extreme. Our view is that the Court of Appeal mischaracterized what this commission did. Be that as it may, the applicability of the CTS decision is necessarily constrained by the facts as found by the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal there found that there was no reliable population information and the commission had mistakenly used the absence of population information to disregard other evidence of threat to the Fisher. We think that's wrong in mischaracterizing what the commission did. Nonetheless, this commission should view that set of facts as constraining and limiting the reach and scope and application of that CTS decision. As explained in the letter, and I won't go into it in detail here.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Curry, your time is, you need to summarize.
There are many reasons as set forth in the letter for the commission to take a reasonable interpretation of the application and scope of the CTS decision. Those reasons really go to the core of the commission's function in the listing process. A wide-ranging view of the application of that decision would essentially gut the discretionary function of the commission in the advancement to candidacy process. And for that reason, we urge you to adopt the interpretation of the CTS decision as set forth in our letter. Thank you very much.
Any questions, Mr. Carr? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Walt Manziel.
President Rogers, members of the commission, Walt Manziel representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. We deplore the actions of petitioners in trying to compare apples to oranges in the case of the salamander versus the Fisher. Dr. Loff clearly enunciated several months ago the shortcomings in the petition to list the Fisher, that the petitioners had not done their homework in meeting the requirements of the law. The basic law has been upheld as it stands of what is supposed to be take place before a species can be an candidate for listing. And all of these actions by the petitioners are merely in runs to try to get the department engaged in extensive research that they themselves don't want to pay for or fund or do to meet the criteria of the law. We support clearly the listing of any animal that the science proves is in danger. We also support the delisting of animals that have come back, but we want that based on science and not emotion. And to petition merely on the absence of information that the petitioners themselves should produce is a failure, in our opinion, to meet the requirements of the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? You got to remember the real motivation for connecting the two, Walt. That's because a fisher would eat a salamander if it had half a chance.
You know, the only comment I'd make is we appreciate all the speakers on this matter and understand the gravity of the situation and are taking it all under close review. And I think John has a motion for us.
Yes, he does.
Suggested motion from staff. Fish and Game Commission directs commission staff to prepare findings and present other options, including but not limited to reconsideration. Commission staff shall have those findings and other options available for review and possible action during the commission's February 2009 meeting.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
A second? Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Thank you.
Moving on to item 11, informational update on North Central Coast Marine Protected Areas, also known as MPAs. And we do have a note at the bottom of this item on the agenda that says adoption hearing is anticipated for March 6th of 09 in Monterey. We are going to be discussing that further during this this item to try to get a better handle on a possible schedule based on department updates. Becky Oda from the Marine Region.
Good morning, President Rogers
morning,
and
Becky.
Commissioners. Good morning. Becky Oda, Acting Program Manager for the MPA project, and I've got a very brief update for you this morning. First of all, the CEQA for the North Central Coast. While all of the chapters have gone back to the contractor, the contractor is about 10 days to 2 weeks behind. We have not received a final. Oh, I'm done. Yay. That was great.
That was very succinct. Thank you.
Becky, we have
like
a different
that?
We have a different standard for the department. At least that's what Sonke thinks.
We have not received a final look at that document from the contractor. Therefore, it is not ready to go out to public comment. The chances are that won't happen until January. We have a 45-day comment period for CEQA. That puts us into February. The revised timeline was for it to be adopted in early March. That's not going to happen. So it's most likely going to be April before that CEQA document is going to be certified, given that timeline. That's it on CEQA, unless you want to talk about that. So we will
Any
need
questions?
We will need guidance today with regards to what you want to do with the regulatory packet, given that update for you on CEQA.
Okay.
The only other update I have for you or item to talk about a little bit is you received a memo in your packet from the department with regards to edible seaweed kelp on the North Central Coast. And in that memo, it had information. You had requested information with regards to SAT evaluation, science advisory team evaluation on harvest of kelp in that, and that's in your memo with regards to what the SAT evaluation was. They did not evaluate edible seaweed in North Central Coast. They did evaluate giant kelp and Macrocystis, but they did not evaluate any hand harvest of edible seaweeds in the Central or North Central Coast. In addition to that, we received information on log data that reports from commercial harvesters out of that area. We were able to receive that data that's updated in your memo with regards to the amount of kelp, that harvestable kelp that came out of the North Central Coast. However, it wasn't enough information to be able to glean how much of that is coming out of the proposed MPAs for the IPA, within the IPA. We did recently receive information from one of the harvesters just this week with regards to we had requested maps from them. From the records, we could not get a good accurate account of what was actually taken out of that proposed MPA within the IPA. So we just received that this week. We will be forwarding that to you, transmitting that to you, along with other correspondence that we have received from the kelp harvesters. And that's it. So before we move away from this agenda item today, again, we will need guidance from you with regards to what you would like to do on the regulatory packet based on that CEQA update and any other comments you may get today.
I think we have several speaker cards on this. We're going to need to go through all the public comment before we then we'll discuss a possible new schedule.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Becky.
If you're ready, we can go. Well, one thing that I'd like to clarify for the public is that this issue, or today on the agenda, is informational update of North Central Coast Marine Protected Areas. This is not an official public comment period for the regulatory process on this item. So keep in mind that your comments today are not part of the regular public record on this regulatory item. We will be rescheduling public comment for this as we talk about the new schedule and then possible adoption schedule. Our first speaker today is going to be Jim Martin and Milo Vukovic together. They have several cards, commissioners, ceded to them, and they've asked for an extended period of time to show a DVD and give some description on their issues on abalone, and the president has granted that.
I just want to make a comment. There was a couple commission meetings ago where I asked that we have the opportunity to listen to what these guys had to say, even if we had to agendize it. And so my request is that give them, because they have all the speaker cards, is to have a chance to hear them out. But I do want to ask before you start, Jim. This is you're going to be speaking on abalone. We have a speaker who speaks on every agenda item at every commission meeting on abalone, and I want to. I've asked him many times. He keeps saying "we" when he speaks. Is Paul Weakland representing you guys at all?
No.
Okay, that's good, because for this, just speaking for this commissioner alone, if he speaks for you guys, then it's dead on arrival coming from him. So I just wanted to clear that up.
Thank you. Which one of these is the one? Oh, okay, that's the video and that's the PowerPoint. The PowerPoint, please. Thank you, President Rogers and commissioners, for allowing us a little bit of extra time for this presentation. We're basically giving you a little more information about the North Central Coast process, and we'll be presenting you some data based on the punch cards that we submit in the abalone fishery. Today, this presentation is brought to you by RFA and the Sonoma County Abalone Network. Abalone diving is a family tradition on the North Coast. And just to introduce ourselves one more time, RFA, our members have contributed thousands of hours to the MLPA process. We're not sitting back and waiting for something to happen. As I mentioned yesterday, we worked to pass AB 1187, which increased penalties and including jail time for the illegal commercialization of abalone and sturgeon. And we helped obtain a $5,000 grant for night vision goggles for the coastal wardens. And on an ongoing basis, we've helped the DFG improve the new abalone tags. RFA is a national grassroots political action organization whose mission is to safeguard the rights of saltwater anglers, protect marine boat and tackle industry jobs, and ensure the long-term sustainability of our nation's marine fisheries. There's Mike Thompson in the middle there. He comes and helps us out with our salmon barbecue up in Fort Bragg. Sonoma County Abalone Network is dedicated to the protection of the North Coast marine environment and the wise management of the abalone resource. We work closely with DFG on abalone regulations. We offer rewards of up to $5,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of abalone poachers. And we've paid $8,000 for DFG enforcement to travel up to Canada to learn about new enforcement techniques. Provided $7,500 to buy patrol boat engines for the wardens. Bought coastal wardens cameras and binoculars. We helped the DFG biologists with their creel census, and our directors and members sit on the rack. We work with DFG biologists to manage the abalone for high abundance and a healthy resource for the future. There's our president of SCAN, Milo Vukovic, talking to the public out in the campgrounds about how to fill out these new abalone punch cards properly. A couple of points I'd like to make about abalone biology. They're slow growing and residential. So there's no spillover effect to the fishery with these MPAs. And you've heard a lot about connectivity between the reserves, but the larval dispersal for abalone is less than 1/10 of a mile. So to get that connection, you'd have to have MPAs every 10 feet or so. They also require a minimum population density for successful spawning, and so a lot of our management efforts have gone to prevent serial depletion due to localized overfishing. So our fishery is limited because of the steep access to the private property on the North Coast. It's primarily a shore-based fishery, and we've built in a reserve component by banning scuba gear, so that leaves the whole deeper waters untouched. It has a very high economic value to the local economy, and there's only about 30 access points in the 100 miles between Point Reyes and Point Arena. There's a picture of some of the access. That's Horseshoe Cove. You can see a rope. People rappel down some of these steeper areas to go abalone diving. The economic value of the fishery was $7.8 million in 2002 and $9.9 million in 2006. And over the last 10 years, we've contributed $5.2 million for research and stock assessments through our punch card fees. We'll now look at the social value of the fishery. Here's some young abalone processors out at the campground. We just can't put a price on this. There's a group, Testadura. They have an annual abalone feed up at Ocean Cove, and those are the group we talk to. That gives you an idea how many people come. It's not just the divers, but their families and friends coming up having fun. So the MLPA requires that you consider this socioeconomic data, and the whole process never, despite our repeated requests, especially Bill Bernard, to consider this, they never did. And you have time to correct this oversight. Now, here's one of the key things on the abalone and management recovery plan. In the event of a site closure, the total allowable catch for the entire fishery will be reduced to address the potential shift in effort in other areas. However, an adjustment in the TAC would not completely protect areas outside the closure from effort shift and subsequent population declines. So one of the questions we had for the department was, how much is the TAC going to be reduced on the basis of these MLPA closures? So one of the things we've worked on was with BLM, and we were really pleased when they opened up the new Storneta Public Lands. We're a partner with BLM in their California Coastal Monument. There's some of the seaweed harvesters that you've heard about at Sea Lion Cove, hand harvesting that sea palm fronds. We were down there on Memorial Day, and there's a group of them there. And that's a sustainable de minimis fishery. And we're happy to contribute $1 million for all the bird watchers and divers and anglers through our SFRA money for the purchase of that land. At this point, I'd like to hand it over to Milo, and he's going to talk about some of the punch card data.
Good morning. Milo Vukovic, president of Sonoma County Abalone Network, also known as SCAN. We'll start in the north, up at Point Arena. This, of course, is the big reserve that's going to be there. We know that that is going to be there and that these big reserves are going to be throughout the state of California. And we know that there's going to be collateral damage to our fishery from it, but it's minimal. All these reserves put together, the ones that are needed to make this system, only cause an effort shift of 6,000 in our fishery. But all these little SMCAs that target our fishery for no reason at all, like right there, Sea Lion Cove right below it, brings that effort shift up to 26,000, which is 20% of our fishery. And some people have said, well, we're up here because our favorite place to dive is going to get closed out or something. Well, can you see that little speck right there out in the ocean a couple miles offshore? Inside that reserve, well, that's my favorite place to dive right there. That's Arena Rock. It's about 1 acre underwater, totally wild out there, way offshore, currents, wild out there, beautiful. and untouched, and that's the best place to dive. And you've never heard us complain about it, and you won't. We know there's going to be some of those damages, but this is about the fishery. It's not about individual places to dive. Now, we're losing all of this abalone habitat right here, all the way down to Sea Lion Cove. This is a long way. As you can see, it's more coastline than Sea Lion Cove is, for reference. And this is what... I won't go forward from that. Did I mess it up now? This is what that part of the coastline looks like. It's all abalone habitat all through here, all through this, all this rocky area with all these spurs and grooves is great abalone habitat. And you can't see how far this goes, but it goes about twice as far as you can see to get down to Sea Lion Cove. Now, once you get past Sea Lion Cove, this is all cliffs, 100-foot cliffs. This is all private property, and people who live here can't even access the ocean. It's cliffs straight up and down, all the way to Arena Cove, which is right there. So all these miles are untouched by shore. You just can't get there. Then the cliffs start again right after you come out of Arena Cove and run all the way to Moat Creek. Can't get in anywhere except Moat Creek. Then they go back to cliffs again all the way to Saunders Reef at Schooner's Gulch. So there's no access except the specific places that I just told you about. Now, what happens is, in 2004, this red line is Arena Lighthouse. And in 2004, Stornetta got purchased and opened up. So you can see the effort shift right here from Arena Cove and Moat Creek. They went down as the lighthouse went up, which included Stornetta. And then other people wanting to check it out. It's a new place, plus rock pickers and a lot of easy pickings in the intertidal shot this way up here. And then it starts to taper off into 2006. Then in 2007, we know it drops down considerably. We already have some of the data, but they won't release the actual number yet, so we don't know for sure, but it starts to drop down. And then this is all going to be closed. Lighthouse will be closed, and if you close Sea Lion Cove with it, it drops straight down to zero. So that was at 18,000, and the average is about 8,000, so that's going to cause a 10,000 abalone effort shift in this area. Well, Arena Cove was 60% of the fishery, and Moat Creek is 40% of the fishery. So we took that 10,000 and put 6,000 into Arena Cove and 4,000 into Moat Creek. And that's going to push that up to levels you can see, which is never operated at before. And Moat Creek will be the same thing, at levels it's never operated at before. And that's why we're saying this effort shift is going to cause problems inside our fishery. Now, this is Sea Lion Cove, and this line up here is where the SMCA starts. And everything above that is in a reserve, and it's larger than this entire area. And down here is where the SMCA ends. So what happened here? Well, you can see all this white water, and you can see how rough this can be. And this isn't even that bad a day. But right behind here, you see how calm it is? Well, what happened was, this is our access right here. See that little line coming down? That's the only way you can get in there. And all this is cliffs all the way along here. There's no way to get in anywhere except right there. So Humboldt State went down there, commissioned by DFG to do this study, and they took a lot of students, and it's a teaching exercise for them, and they came in here to do transects. Well, they intended to put transects in a lot of these areas out here, but it was so rough they couldn't go out there. And the fishery was about to open, so they couldn't reschedule. So they went in here, and they just put all the transects, and they did all their survey right in this little spot in the access right behind the island. Now, if you want to know the health of this entire SMCA area, you would have your transects all spread out. You might have one or two behind there, and all along here and all through here. This is all abalone habitat. But that wasn't done. It wasn't done in anticipation of any of this stuff happening in 2008. So there's the transects behind the island, and this is all the subtidal transects done underwater. All the intertidal transects were done all in these little rock areas right across here and right along here in this island. And then across here, there's a land bridge at low tide. You can actually walk from there out to this island. So those transects that I just showed you right here, you don't hear about that. What you hear about is this 80% depletion, which is only referring to this little intertidal survey that was done right around here, which is a little tiny part of the abalone habitat. It's not, most abalone live underwater. So what did this reveal? This revealed that at 15 feet and greater, there's 7,200 abalone per hectare in the access, and there's 3,000 per hectare at 15 feet and less. So if you took 30 to 40 transects and stuck them in Timber Cove, Ocean Cove, Stillwater Cove, or any of our accesses, you'd find the same kind of numbers, in fact, even less. So it's healthy in the access area, and that's where everybody comes in to dive. It's protected. It's easy diving, as you can see. If you want to come out here, you're going to get roughed up a little bit. So anyway, there's no way to know what the population of abs is out in any of this rest of this area. And to draw conclusions from this little tiny bit of information about this area is ridiculous. Now, I've dove here, and I've dove here before, and this area is absolutely packed full of abalone. There's only one way for me to let you know what kind of untouched abalone resources are in this area. So I went right here. It was too rough to dive there or there when I went. So I dropped in right here with an underwater video camera, and I filmed it for you. So if we could put up that video right now, guys.
When did you do this, Milo?
About a month ago.
Okay.
Okay, stop it right there if you could.
Good Lord.
This is what an abalone looks like for people who haven't seen it underwater. It just looks like a rock, looks like the same as the rest of the ground, but you'll see these black lips going around it, and that's how you can pretty much tell what an abalone is. And the light's reflecting in there. It's hard for me to point them all out for you, but there's another one right over there.
Is that Sankey's dive belt sitting next to that? what size are, if you have an estimate on the size of these abs?
These are big abs. These are old growth abs. In fact, you'll see as I'm filming along, I stop at one point just so you know. My finger with my glove on is 9 inches from there to there, and I'll put it over an ab that you'll see that's 10.5 inches. And you'll be able to see all through this whole thing there's old growth abs. And normally when you see an area where people have been picking abs, you'll find areas like this, and then you'll see just a big clean spot on the rocks where somebody's taking an ab here or there. Throughout this whole thing, you won't even see that. It's just abs after abs after abs. Now, keep in mind that if abalone in this area were 10,000 abs per hectare, you'd have one ab every 3 feet, 3 feet by 3 feet, every square meter. And if it was depleted by 80%, I would have to swim 15 feet to find an ab, another 15 feet to find an ab, and in 90 feet, I'd see about 6 abs. If it was depleted down to those kind of things. These are all abs.
By the way, if you want the commission to understand what you mean by size, you're going to have to put everything in terms of our understanding of abalone size, and that's what we call sunky size, okay, which is 10 pounds is one sunky size. Okay, so well, as a percent of that is what we're...
He does get kind of small abs, but he's catching on.
Size does matter with Sunky. When's lunch? Are we ready for lunch?
I forgot to bring my hammers, but...
You sure can't hold your breath a long time.
I actually had to come up once for air.
You know, when I first started diving in Catalina in the 50s, that's the way it looked.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore.
That's for sure.
Doesn't the commission have the power to reopen the season?
That's what is known as the sunk.
Destiny is calling me.
That's what is known as the Sankey Salivation Index.
You can look in that crack right there and just see abs after abs after abs.
Well, you really know how to hurt us, Milo. What's the depth of water right here?
20 to 25 feet. And in this entire video, I only swam about 100 feet, and I counted in this video 206 abs in that area. So if you equated that to per hectare, that would be like 60 to 70,000 abs per hectare. But, of course, I'm not swimming a transect, which is straight across, going across the rocks and counting the way. I'm just showing you what the density of the population is like. But it's huge. And it's untouched. There's no clean spots or no missing abs. Everywhere you'd expect to see them, they're there. It's just untouched. I was afraid of that. I almost didn't say where.
Shall I say the obvious that we get the point?
Well, there's one more thing you need to see here. When I measure this ab, that's going to really upset you. And I shortened this down to 8 minutes. This went on for 24 minutes underwater. Same thing over and over again.
All right, let's fast forward through this and get to the night.
Get to the place, if you can fast forward it, to the place where you're, want to show us something.
I think it's right past it. I don't have the ability to fast forward anything here.
Can you guys fast forward, AGB? Do so and get to the place where Milo has a...
It can't be more than a few seconds here. Yeah. There's some. There's a few urchins in there. Just a little bit more. Just push it forward. There's an urchin right there. Are we going backwards or forward? Okay. Oh, we could back that up there right there. There's an back a little bit more. There's abalone right there. That's abalone on top of abalone right there. Not enough room for them, so they're stacking.
Okay. Was that where you were measuring something right there?
There, right there, yeah. Okay, no, keep going from here, right here. There's one that's sticking up a little bit. I just tightened him up.
Okay, keep fast-forwarding. Let's get to the measurement point.
It'll be right here.
Well, that's the end of it.
I think that was back. Oh, yeah, it's just back me from that. You're right in between it.
What are we looking for, Mylon?
We're further back than we were now, I think. I don't know. I'm kind of lost now.
Well, the point was what?
Anyway, the point is there's a lot of big old abs there. It's not like this has been picked or anybody's working it.
Got it. Okay. All right. All right. Enough for the video.
Back to the PowerPoint.
Thank you, Mylon.
Okay. All right. So that's
okay, Milo. The group has now used 25 minutes, which is a considerable amount of time.
Okay.
The group now has 5 more minutes. So what you need to do is summarize what you're doing, and if there's anybody else who wants to say something, we have 5 minutes to do this.
Okay, I'll get the smoke in here.
30 minutes is a very long period
of
time.
I'll skip a lot of this stuff then. Okay. Saunders Reef, that's the next place south of here. The abalone is just as thick as the film I just showed you there. Very few abs get taken out of there. It's almost inaccessible. And the reason, the rationale for making this SMCA here was to restore fin fish. And we can't figure out how banning abalone restores fin fish. So there's absolutely no reason to close Saunders Reef to abalone diving. Now, this is the big problem down at Fort Ross. This area right here, this is Fort Ross. There takes 37,000 abs a year coming out of Fort Ross. There's 15 sites we dive right there, and the IPA, we would lose 8 of them. So almost half of the fishery is lost if it passed away. And this is why we ask for the line change, because this area of Fisk Mill Cove right here is almost 7,800 abs. And that's the only place other than Fort Ross is protected from the northwest swell. And that's why we dive this place. It's bad access. It's a long walk. But when a northwest swell is running, you either go there or you go there. And what's going to happen, if you close Fisk Mill Cove, most of this area is going to get transferred right to Fort Ross. And you can already see this is already a problem. If it gets any higher, it's going to be even more of a problem. This is coming from Jenner. That's what it's cliffs. That's why Fort Ross is the first place you can get to. Fort Ross is the point way off in the distance you can see out there. And this is what it would look like if the IPA passes the way it is. We lose all those 7 sites. Fort Ross goes to 47,000 per hectare, and the other ones go up proportionally. I divided them according to their percentage of the fishery. But the big problem here is, if Fort Ross closes and it pushes it up 10,000 more than it is, and it's already, the biologists are a little bit shaky on Fort Ross, you push it up there. If this stops and the ARMP or the department comes along and says, we need to close this for a few years or for a while, there's absolutely nowhere you can transfer this 47,000 abalone into these other little places left in the fishery. When this domino falls, it's going to take all the rest of these dominoes with it. None of these small areas can handle that volume of abalone. So if you give us the line change that we're asking for, it reduces that 10,000 down to by 7,000 to only 3,000. And if you allow it at Jenner, it reduces that 10,000 by 8,000. So Fort Ross only ends up going up 2,000. And we can manage that. And with a little diver education, telling them to move more of that towards Salt Point, we can keep this fishery going for a long time. Other than that, when that domino falls, I'd like somebody to tell me where in the world we could put that many abs and when we only have 8 places left to dive in that entire area. And the displacement there is 16,000 abs.
Thank you, Mylon. Any questions? No, thank you.
I will have after we hear the rest of the speakers.
Jim, we're down to about 2.5.
Okay. Just very briefly, I'm going to cycle through all this stuff. We talked about the rationale. What we're asking you to consider at this point is just to include an option in the noticed regulations for a line change at Stewart's Point to move that southern boundary up to 38 degrees, 37.5 minutes. And then if you want to consider allowing abalone take at Sea Lion Cove, Saunders Reef, and the Russian River State Marine Conservation Areas. This doesn't mean that you have to make a decision about this now. It just makes sure that the regulatory package has all the options you need. When this sinks in, you think about this. This is about our fishery, okay? This is extremely important to us. A lot of divers, I want to thank the Dolphin Dive Club here in Sacramento, NorCal Skin Divers, Monterey Tritons, who showed up and supported the fishery. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. It was a good report. And now, we have further public comment here.
Yes. We have several speaker cards, and let me remind everyone once again that today's agenda item is an informational update. This is not an official public comment on the existing regulation proposal. And at the end of this discussion, the commissioners will decide on the future schedule of public public recommendation meetings. We have a couple of folks that have speaker cards seated. They'll get 4 minutes. The rest will get three. Jennifer Fong, followed by Samantha Murray, followed by Karen Garrison. Please line up along the wall, and if you can be even briefer than the time, we would appreciate it. Jennifer Fong, not here.
Yeah, it is. Please do line up.
Everybody up here.
Sam, yeah, let's. Yeah, thanks.
And state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Fong. I'm a community college student at Consumnes River College and a native of Sacramento. Just want to say that as a Californian and a lover of hiking, I have developed a closeness to our coast's beauty and the ecosystems that thrive within it. I am proud to have this wildlife as my backyard, and I want to be sure that we try to preserve areas as best we can. With ocean health declining all over the world, our oceans are facing more threats than ever before. Thus, I am here today to help represent a number of Californians that wish for our state to lead the way in taking steps to protect and restore coastal wildlife habitats. Please listen to us citizens as we urge you to adopt the IPA with no further cuts. This is a key step toward reaching common ground. Thank you very much for listening to me today.
Thank you, Ms. Fong.
Samantha Murray, followed by Karen Garrison, followed by Thomas Lyons.
Sam, good morning.
Good morning. Samantha Murray, Ocean Conservancy. I don't want to take a lot of your time because I think you know where I stand because I speak at every meeting. But I did want to just make a few clarifications on some of the issues raised during the presentation you just saw. First, you know, to say that the BRTF failed to consider the abalone fishery, I think that's a real mischaracterization. As you know, the RSG considered abalone at every turn, with every boundary, and with every permissible and non-permissible take in every MPA, and the BRTF did the same. Secondly, the graph that shows all the, you know, supposed and predicted displaced effort because of closing down Sea Lion Cove, you know, those numbers, I think he said that, you know, 18,000 is what Sea Lion Cove is at now. But if you look at 2004 and before, it's at 4,000 because that was before it opened and became public lands. So to say that all that effort is going to be displaced, I think is also kind of a mischaracterization because up until a few years ago, people weren't diving there at all for abalone. Again, I don't know if you remember two meetings ago when I gave that handout that showed the transects. So I think that's also a mischaracterization because DFG, and certainly DFG could probably clear this up for you themselves, they did take transects both from the intertidal and the subtidal, both in 2004 and 2007. So it wasn't just done by these students and just in the intertidal. Saunders Reef. The purpose was not just to protect fin fish. The purpose is to protect ecosystems because that's the purpose of the MLPA. And so that's sort of where we start with the MLPA. We start with ecosystems, and then we have built in flexibility, or you have built in flexibility into the MLPA to allow for some take in some areas we're just absolutely important to the local economy. And that's sort of how we get into those flexible areas of SMCAs. And again, at Saunders, the middle ground proposal, Proposal 1-3 that's still on the table, did have shore fishing and abalone allowed at Saunders Reef, and DFG explicitly pushed back and said that was just too permissible and it was no good and it wasn't going to accomplish anything as an SMCA, which is why the BRTF explicitly chose to only allow salmon and urchin take out of that SMCA. So other than that, I think you know where I stand. I support the IPA, and I think most people do. So I would really urge you to pass it as is. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Samantha. Any questions? No, thank you.
Karen Garrison, Thomas Lyons, Christine Acevedo, Terry Shepard.
Good morning, Karen.
Karen Garrison, the much maligned NRDC. So I want to start by congratulating you.
You mean self-inflicted? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Good one, Richard. So I want to start by congratulating you on investing in technology and tools for the Marine Life Protection Act. As you may have noticed earlier this week, EcoTrust won a Mellon Award for $50,000 for its mapping tool to collect economic information. And I think it's just one example of the creativity inspired by what you're doing with the MLPA and part of the legacy you leave with it. I want to encourage you to hold firm on the IPA. The process was open and inclusive, and I also want to urge you to strengthen it if you open it at all. We submitted written comments on the abalone issues, so I'll direct you to those. You may get them after this meeting. But I'll summarize a few quick points. First, the proposals to allow abalone fishing aren't just technical changes, as some have called them. They will impact shallow water ecosystems, and they'll certainly impact abalone populations. And the Department of Fish and Game studies do show an 80% decline in the 0 to 16-foot range. They show that we're still above the acceptable levels in the 16 to 24-foot range, the range those photos were taken in, but it's only a matter of time, I would submit. The DFG studies also show that Arena Cove, which is nearby and not in any protected area, still left open, is actually more productive than the very sensitive Sea Lion Cove, which is a nursery area and clearly vulnerable to impacts from fishing. Second point, the agencies that manage the adjacent lands to Saunders and Sea Lion Cove both support the IPA designations, and their support is going to be critical for enforcement. The Bureau of Land Management has actually called Sea Lion Cove virtually unmanageable. And you have a whole letter detailing those concerns from them. Third, the changes at Saunders create new feasibility problems and, according to the Department of Fish and Game, undermine the key purposes of the Marine Life Protection Act, and I won't go into details there. That's in their feasibility study. And fourth, the IPA clearly meets the Marine Life Protection Act requirements to incorporate views of local communities. And one example of that is that all the heavily used sites are still open in the IPA. Arena Cove to Moat has an annual take that averages over 17,000 abalone. Salt to Ocean Cove has over 29,000. And Fort Ross to Reef Camp has over 37,000, whereas Saunders has less than 1,000, and the Russian River area has 2,300. That didn't even come up in the discussion. So displacement, I think, is basically within the range of variability from year to year at the Fort Ross to Reef Camp area. And with that, I will leave you to your deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Any questions? Thank you.
Thomas Lyons, Christine Acevedo, Terry Shepard, Noel Walsh.
President Rogers and Commissioners, thank you for your opportunity to speak. I'm Thomas Lyons, representing the California Coastkeeper Alliance, which represents 12 waterkeeper groups spanning the coast from the Oregon border to San Diego. First, the Coastkeeper Alliance commends the transparency of the MLPA initiative and the success with which all stakeholders have been incorporated into this process. We encourage the Commission to adopt the IPA as is and to maintain all protections currently in the IPA, and we oppose any revisions to the IPA as have been suggested by others to more closely resemble the prior proposal 2XA in the northern part of the study region. Lastly, the California Coastkeeper Alliance would like to underscore that the IPA has achieved support from many varied interests, including support from thousands of members of the public, many RSG members, a letter from over 40 divers, including abalone divers, letters from Aquaria, and support resolutions from Sonoma County, San Mateo County, Alameda County, Marin County, and SF City and County. On behalf of our Coastwide Alliance of Waterkeepers, we would like you to adopt the IPA as written. Thank you so much for your opportunity to comment this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Lyons.
Nope. Christine Acevedo, Terry Shepard, Noel Walsh. I'm Maranth Wise.
Good morning. My name is Terry Shepard, and I am a...
Excuse, Christine Acevedo was called. Is she here?
No, she
hasn't. Okay. Terry Shepard, go ahead.
Hi. Once again, my name is Terry Shepard, and thank you for giving me a chance to speak here this morning. The ocean plays a really big part in my life because I love to fish, and I have been fishing for many years now. I also enjoy the beach, and I have a strong love for marine life. I want my daughter and my future grandchildren to be able to enjoy the ocean the same way that I have. I'm in full support of the strongest preservation possible, and I do believe that we have an obligation to our future generation to give them this, and that's why I support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Senator. Ms. Shepard.
Noel Walsh, Amaranth Wise, Francesca Coe, Brian Jennings.
Hi, thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Noel Walsh, and I live in Elk Grove, California. I am a student, and ever since I was a toddler, it's been hard to keep me from the ocean. I grew up in Morro Bay, California, and I spent my days in tide pools, whale watching, bird watching, canoeing, and swimming.
How was the whale watching in the tide pool?
When you have Barbie whales, it's very imaginative.
That's right, Julian.
I still do love the beach, and I try to go at least once a month, and I do still enjoy the ocean as much as possible. And I recently found out that I have a nephew on the way, so my mind is open now to understand more than ever what conservation would mean. And my nephew deserves the same experiences that I have, if not much better. And I am in support of the IPA because we don't have the right to take this from our children, and we do need to preserve this for our future generations. Thank you for letting me speak.
Amaranth Wise, Francesca Coe, Brian Jennings, Mike Summers.
Hi, my name is Amaranth Wise. I grew up in Monterey, although I live here in Sacramento now. And to me, having your seawater protected and the life within it has always just been a fact of life because Monterey Bay is a sanctuary. And so it comes as a great surprise to me that there are areas that don't share the same protections as it does. To be honest, I don't want to have us go back 20 years from now and have to say, oops, we were wrong, and have nothing that we can do about it. I'd much rather that we put the protection in place now and not have to worry about it in future. And that's all I have to say. Thank you so much for listening to us.
Thank you, Ms. West.
Francesca Coe, Brian Jennings, Mike Summers, Michelle Wesley.
Good morning, President Rogers and commissioners. Thank you for this opportunity for public comment. I'm Francesca Coe. I'm a North Central Coast stakeholder. I'm an abalone diver. I'm a scuba instructor. I'm a California taxpayer. I think it's also important to note, as we are concerned about monitoring and regulations, that I am a volunteer DFG science diver and will do everything in my power to support recruiting additional divers to support this effort because I believe in it, and I've been a volunteer the whole time. The Regional Stakeholder Group and the Blue Ribbon Task Force recognize the economic and recreational importance of abalone fishing to the North Central Coast. The IPA alternative represents a compromise designed to optimize ecosystem benefits for all ecosystems and all species while minimizing impact on abalone diving and the fishery. I'd just like to point out a couple of things. The RSG included three abalone divers, including myself, and many local divers participated in the meetings and wrote letters. The DFG analyzed abalone impacts and alternatives at two stages of the design process to help stakeholders reduce potential impacts. So there has been thorough and comprehensive discussion and debate. The IPA's largest marine reserve at Stewart's Point accounts for an annual take of less than 12,000 abalone. That is significantly smaller than another proposal represented by 2XA that contains the Black Point SMR with an annual take of over 12,600. In terms of displacement, all of these proposals are about on par, and the IPA unequivocally is the lowest. I'd also like to comment that I have previously submitted a letter from June, the IPA letter of support from divers in June 2008. It was augmented with additional names, hundreds of names, at the Santa Rosa meeting, which I handed to you all at Santa Rosa. And also to underscore that the Bureau of Land Management supports the Sea Lion Cove inclusion, and that there is a letter from stakeholders, including the Coastal Commission, state parks, and resolutions in support of the IPA from the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors. All of these folks have taken great consideration about what we're trying to leave California with, which is a legacy of abundant and beautiful marine resources. I support the IPA. I encourage you to also do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, hang on, please. I have a question for you.
Yes.
First off, thank you for the participation in the process. I think that adds a lot of credibility to what you're saying, and so hence my question to you.
And my flat tire this morning that didn't stop me from getting here.
Your flat tire.
And then your commitment as well, which is already obvious. Tell me in 120 seconds or less what the downside would be on the request from the abalone divers. In your opinion, what is it that is damaged? Do you think the fishery is in risk? Do you not think it's healthy, the abalone fishery? Or just tell me what would be the downside.
Specific to Sea Lion Cove, there's an important abalone nursery there, and the nursery is much different than old growth. So that's one specific item that Chair Susan Golding specifically investigated, which is why she included it. I was a member of the 1-3 proposal, and we didn't have it in our proposal, and she opted to put it back in. I think one of the most important takeaways is that the IPA considered everyone and everything along the way, and it was a hard-fought compromise. And relative to abalone diving, the most popular spots, Fort Ross, Pedades, some of the points in Salt Point, all of those have been left open. So there is no shortage of places to go diving for abalone. And the places that were left open were actually the ones that have the most easily accessed trails and trailheads, so that there would be fewer injuries or occurrences of safety problems. So I think that for me, for someone who's been participating for many years in this now, and for all the voices that I've heard brought forward, for there to be an end game screen to be able to just come to the commission and get what you want signals a disrespect for the entire process.
Okay, and I get that, and we are the end game, actually. And so that's why we get to do that, because otherwise we just let the BRTF make the decision and don't even waste our time with it, you know, if we're not to look at it and analyze and determine if we think it's adequate or inadequate. But you didn't tell me anything that was wrong with it. What would be, other than the first thing you said, you didn't say anything else that you felt would be damaging. I understand the end game. I understand it's different. I understand the easy access points. But what would hurt if we did make? What is the fishery? Is the resource?
You mean from a biological perspective?
Well, in her opinion, what would be any opinion? What is it that biologically, I guess, sure. What technically would be wrong with making that amendment?
It's about ecosystems. This is not fisheries management. And to provide special amendments to treat it as it is fisheries management is, I think, incorrect. Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Ryan Jennings, Mike Summers, Michelle Wesley, Gina Goodhill.
Hello. Good morning. I'll keep this brief. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm very happy to have the opportunity. My name is Brian Jennings, and I am from Sacramento, currently live here as well. I'm here to show my support as an avid enthusiast for sustaining the natural wildlife of our oceans. As we all know, California has an incredibly diverse habitat along our coast. As a result, we have the privilege to enjoy that specialty. However, we also have a responsibility, of course, to preserve the wonderful habitat that we have, and we need to do everything that we can to ensure that it remains healthy. I'm asking you to adopt the integrated preferred alternative, the IPA. It's fair to everyone who enjoys our oceans, including our fishermen and our divers. It has taken in the public comments, the public comments of hundreds. And so, again, it's fair to a lot of people. Now, most importantly, it puts us in the right direction for complete protection of our oceans in the future. So, again, I am asking you to adopt the IPA plan to, of course, preserve our oceans for future generations. So thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you, Mr. Jennings.
Mike Summers, Michelle Wesley, Gina Goodhill, Paul Weakland. Is Mike Summers here?
I think I'm actually
I'm sorry?
I don't think there's other people here.
You're Michelle Wesley?
No, I'm Gina Goodhill. I don't think she's here.
Michelle Wesley or Mike Summers here? Okay. Gina Goodhill.
First of all, thank you so much for your time. My name is Gina Goodhill, and I am the Oceans Associate for Environment California. Environment California is a statewide citizen-based environmental organization, and we have 70,000 members within California, as well as additional members through our national chapters. And I'm here today to talk about marine protected areas on the North Central Coast and why Environment California supports the integrated preferred alternative. California's coasts and oceans, obviously, right now are suffering from a lot of problems, most recently on Monday when there was an oil spill in Santa Barbara, just to give you an idea. And under the integrated preferred alternative, we'll be adopting a plan that's not perfect, but that would go far in protecting some of our most unique marine areas from further destruction. And the Farallon Islands and Point Reyes are habitats that Environment California has worked to protect in the past. And so we really applaud their inclusion in the proposed plans. We worked last year on a national level to double the size of the Gulf of Farallon Sanctuary, which ended up failing by one vote, which is why our state leadership is even more critical on this. So once again, the real reason that I'm here today is just to make it emphatically clear that our members and the millions of Californians who care about our oceans do not want this bold legacy of marine protected areas just to suffer the death of 1,000 small cuts. Every so-called technical change will directly result in less habitat protection, less biodiversity, and less benefit for the vast majority of Californians. So we urge the esteemed commission to adopt the integrated preferred alternative without any further compromise. Californians want our coast to get the protection that it deserves, and the power lies in your hands. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Goodhill.
Paul Weakland, Greg Peterson, Dan Wolford, Richard Charter.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Concerns about the area south of San Francisco. These areas are abundant with abalones. They are harvestable and sustainable. The areas in San Francisco County, like Muscle Rock, still hold abalones. Rockaway Beach, Fitzgerald, Lindemar, Pedro Point, Pelican Point, Pescadero, Pigeon Point, the Farallon Islands. These areas are large, abundant areas of abalones. We do not believe we are utilizing the abalone resource efficiently or effectively for the most benefit of Californians. One of the biggest things that you're not talking about is poaching. The reason closing these areas down is so detrimental because now you are creating a poacher's paradise. If you haven't noticed in the enforcement, the large poaching rings are being caught inside these marine reserves where no abalone diving is allowed because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out there's no competition. There's lots of abalone. It's easy to get if you're out there to poach. And so that is one of the reasons why the poaching is going on unproliferated south of San Francisco in these high-dense areas, because the game wardens are not really protecting these areas well since they're closed to abalone diving. So why not open up these areas? The Farallon Islands should be a conservation zone. The harvest of abalones and urchins should be allowed. Missed deadlines. Again, here we go. Seems like standard operating procedure when you won't really want to accomplish anything. We just missed the deadline. What penalties or punishments is there for missing a deadline? Well, obviously none. Is there any way to penalize contractors who do not fulfill their duties? We believe that these issues are very paramount, and we are creating economic dead zones. We cannot call them marine protected areas because they do not protect the resource from anything but fishing. So you're punishing the fishermen and creating economic dead zones and poaching havens. That is all.
Greg Peterson, Dan Wolford, Richard Charter.
Thank you, commissioners, for letting us speak. I'm Greg Peterson. I'm a citizen. I'm a resident of Fairfield. I took time off work to be here. I'm in sales, but I do enjoy the ocean. I enjoy the bay, fishing, and scuba diving. I have very fond memories of fishing, for example, with my father when I was a boy in Bodega Bay, catching a flounder the size of our boat. We had a small boat, and it was huge. That was very enjoyable. I care about protecting the oceans because it's really our duty as stewards of the ocean. And just to point out, in sales, if you don't have product to sell, if your product is depleted, you go out of business. So it's important for us to protect the fisheries for the fishermen's sake as well as the public's. So therefore, I ask you to support the IPA with no further cuts. The citizens of California are behind you. It is all of our ocean. There are particular groups that want particular things, but really it belongs to all of us. So I encourage you I support the IPA, no further cuts, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Dan Wolford, Richard Charter.
Morning. Morning, Dan.
Good morning, commissioners, President Rogers, commissioners. My name is Dan Wolford. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Partnership for Sustainable Oceans and the Coastside Fishing Club. I'm just here to reiterate the PSO's support for 2XA and for the IPA as modified by the three minor technical corrections that we've brought forth before in our letter to you. I want to remind you that those changes would not change any level of protection. They would, this is relative to the IPA now, any level of protection, any of the MPA boundaries, or any of the MPA designations, or the structure itself. But it will provide significant and much-needed socioeconomic relief to the North Coast communities. And it will do that without impacting the healthy abalone fishery or to the nearshore fishes. My primary purpose here today, though, is to update our economic analysis that we provided to you at the last meeting. We took into account, in the interval now, we've taken into account the DFG analysis, which was not an economic analysis but was a take analysis. We've utilized that to restructure the way we did the analysis, and I want to just kind of briefly tell you that the amendments that we're talking about can still provide on the order of $1 million annually of relief in that North Coast area, and it brings the economic impact of the IPA much closer in line with the economic impact of 2XA. In fact, essentially makes them equal, and so that those amendments that we've been asking for are definitely needed. It would provide significant help to the North Coast communities without impact to the fishery itself. So the other thing that I want to do today is to ask that the regulatory package include sufficient content to give you, the commission, the flexibility to consider the request that we've been making and hopefully to ultimately adopt those minor technical changes to the IPA. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions? No. Thank you.
Richard Charter is our final speaker on this item.
Good morning. My name is Richard Charter. I'm speaking today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife. We express our appreciation for the diligence and dedication shown by this commission to protecting and restoring the vitality of California's unique marine ecosystems. And I'd like to thank each of you for the privilege of serving on the North Central Coast Regional Stakeholders Group these last, really, almost a year now. During the very thorough and painstaking months of meetings and negotiations leading to the integrated preferred alternative now before you. We would have liked to have seen more extensive protection, particularly for certain areas within the IPA, but we encourage its adoption as proposed as the best achievable compromise without further erosion of any kind. To bring the IPA to you has taken hundreds of hours of study, negotiation, and listening, like you're doing here today. I've been on the other side of the table, and I know there's a lot of players and a lot of interests. With consideration of every single category of stakeholder in the North Central region, often to meet the concerns of communities or user groups, boundaries were moved a quarter of a mile or less at a time. Adjustments were made to levels of protection to maximize long-term benefits while minimizing any need for a short-term socioeconomic adjustments. This is the best we could do, and I believe it will work. And obviously, we're all interested in results. Specific points I would like to emphasize. 3, native interests were represented on the RSG from day one on the North Central Coast MLPA process. We urge the commission to consider the permit system used by the California State Parks as a model for ensuring both continued cultural access combined with conservation. Urchin harvest by commercial operators was carefully considered by our RSG at every step in the design of the MLPA alternatives. An additional urchin harvest beyond that encouraged by the IPA would undermine the success, I believe, of the outcome. And I think the science supports that. With regard to the Point Arena SMR in the IPA, no other portion of the North Central planning area received more stringent and careful consideration in any other part of the planning region. Sea Lion Cove protections were included only after careful consideration of sound science, the positions voiced by the community itself, and of all user groups that came forward during the process to participate in good faith. To now belatedly jump into any arbitrary weakening of protections in the IPA for Point Arena or Sea Lion Cove would violate the good faith efforts of all who worked so hard for so many months to reach the current compromise. Our door was open for several months. As a longtime coastal resident, I supported getting our panel up to Wallala and Point Arena. We had 3 meetings up there to listen to local positions. No further protection, weakening of protections in the critical upwelling area at Point Arena should be entertained. No special exemption for commercial sea palm extraction should be granted. It is critical to protect the full spectrum of life at Point Arena. It is one of 4 upwelling systems of that magnitude on the planet. Finally, special closures, where they're recommended, should be maintained. They were carefully designed, again, moved 100 feet at a time sometimes in the case of special closures. So please go forward, adopt the IPA as proposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charter. Questions? No? Thank you.
That concludes public testimony on today's item. Sankey, do you have follow-up?
Yeah, I just to provide a little context of what at least the department's hoping out of your deliberation here is what we do with the rulemaking package, whether there's any amendments you want us or options to build into it, and then discuss specific timeline. That's what we're hoping to get. Thank you.
Thank you. We will do so.
Just real quick, you know, we've been here and done this before. First of all, I want to go back a little bit when we, in anticipation of these studies in the North area by the Department of Fish and Game several years ago. I think Commissioner Flores was the president of the commission at the time. Bill Gaines came here with a presentation and a map recommending that the department not do their studies in the easy public access areas where the entire public goes and takes out the abalone, because it would not be an accurate study of what's really going on up there. So that video that we saw showing all those abalone is really not a surprise. And we had testimony saying that that's exactly where the studies were done by the department after the heads up that we requested that they be done in a broader scale. I, for one, believe that, first of all, I want to thank all the stakeholders, the people that spoke. And the Blue Ribbon Task Force for the job they did. When we did this in the first area of MPAs, because the commission does have the final word on what's adopted, we made some amendments and changed some boundaries and on behalf of some of the constituent groups. And we pissed off Sonke and the director at the time, and I believe even some of the commission staff by doing that. But that's all right. We're the ones that ultimately, 20 years from now, will be looked at as the people that set up an unprecedented marine protected areas along the coast of California. The five of us get to make that final decision. And as we do that, we have to be cognizant in our own minds that we're doing the right thing and doing what we can to keep the people of this state, the citizens, viable and accessible and protect their resources as well. That being said, and knowing I'll probably piss off Sonke and the director and maybe even our own staff, I'm ready to at least entertain changing the boundary for one of our alternatives to look at down the road when we do make this decision, instead of not having that as an option, like the abalone fishermen had requested, for moving the line north 38 degrees, 37.5 minutes, and give us that opportunity to at least consider that as one of the options. I don't know if that's something we need to make a motion and vote on or not, but that's where the discussion
for,
that I would like to see.
Thank you for posing that, Jim. Let me ask Sonke a question, a technical question, with respect to that which we haven't gone to notice yet, but that with which we are contemplating going to notice. Pardon me. Are the technical changes that have been put forward, particularly by the abalone group, are they within the noticeable scope, the noticing scope that we had envisioned, or would we have to alter what we go to notice with in order to, as Commissioner Kellogg simply says, make up our decision after notice? Will our notice as envisioned cover that or not?
Unfortunately, it depends on which option or you want to put on the table. What you have, just as a quick reminder, you have the IPA, and you have X2A, X3, and then 4, whatever the names are. Yeah, you have three other options. And you can select any or none of those in combinations.
So these boundary line adjustments that have been put forth to us today would not be.
I do not believe the one Commissioner Kellogg just mentioned is in any of the alternatives. But as your staff, we would want to check that. So
well, that's the reason that I'm doing that now, because the last time, the reason you guys got pissed off is we waited too long.
You're
and
correct.
You had to change the whole notification process and everything else, and I want to head that off if we can do it
today. I have personal pain associated with
you know
that.
What? As mad as everybody got at the time, those protected areas are working well, and we're back working together just like we will even when they get pissed off this time. We'll be back working together and accomplishing what we can for the good of the state of California.
Before we make any, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, just hopefully to help frame your discussion here, the good news is we haven't noticed anything.
I understand.
Here's my recommendation. You have the packages and the alternatives. If the commission wants to consider something that different, what staff would do, and you give us permission to include it, first thing we check, is it already there? If it's already there, we won't change anything. If that alternative you want to consider is not there, when we submit the ISOR to the commission, we will build it in there.
We understand.
Okay.
But before we make that direction to you, are there any comments from my other fellow commissioners with respect to this issue, specifically the one on the table brought forward by Jim?
Well, a lot of thoughts and a lot of emotions go into this because I have a lot of esteem for my fellow commissioner. I'm very concerned with a change at this point in time and with an alternative that may or may not have been previously looked at throughout the entire initiative process. At the same time, I've debated this issue in my own mind. What is our role? You know, we should not be just a rubber stamp to a blue ribbon task force in the initiative process. Yet, if we were to undertake the task force, if we were to try to undertake the volume of work they've done, we would do nothing else for the state's resources. That's all we would spend our time on to even begin to undertake the process that they've undertaken. We can't, I don't believe we can sit up here as the commissioner, at least I can't today, and say what give and take were made all the way along this process that resulted in the preferred alternative. And again, I would, if we are going to entertain this motion at all, I would want to send it back to the Blue Ribbon Task Force and say, you hold a meeting, you look at these alternatives, or come back with the justifications. And I also have a problem with our process today because this wasn't even reflected in what's on the agenda. So at least in my agency, I know we couldn't be making a major change without it being appearing on the agenda as such so that everybody could testify. All that being said, I do agree with Jim, and I think the comments that Commissioner, that Dan Richards also suggested, that what is our role? And I think that's been something that I have personally struggled with, and people have asked me, what is the commission's role if you're just going to take what the Blue Ribbon Task Force does? And I keep looking out at Ken because you're here today, rubber stamping, as it would be. So. I guess I'm coming around to, can we even do this today based on our agenda? Secondly, if we're going to do it, don't we owe the respect to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, the initiative process, to ask them for input on this proposal, again, as just another source of information? And I guess the third question I have, Sankey, and I'm sorry to be running on here, is we had one allegation that the department had only looked in the intertidal area. We had another spokesperson from the stakeholder group that said, no, the transects had, the survey work had been done in both areas. Are you familiar with this, or would you need to come back to us with information as to what was really studied in that area?
I'm familiar, but I would prefer to come back to you if you want to address this issue of abalone. I would like the opportunity to present something a little more organized than my off the cuff.
Yeah,
I'm familiar with the transects in the area, but I'm not familiar with the specific data.
Okay,
there were some misrepresentations.
Let me interject. So. I think we take your point, I may.
Yeah.
So let's answer the questions that you have posed in order of magnitude. Number one is, are we able today, given the notice that we have given, to make this decision, this addition
I think Commissioner Gustafson raises a very valid point about the agenda and how this item has been noticed for the public. It's noticed as an informational update. I think that under Bagley-Keene, because it is an informational update, that does put some constraints on the types of actual affirmative actions you can take. However, since it is informational update, I don't see anything that precludes the commission from seeking additional information from the department, from the stakeholder, from the Blue Ribbon Task Force on items that may have come up during the informational update item itself. So Seeking information, I think, is perfectly within the purview of the notice. The
second order of magnitude then would be referring, if we were to do so, referring to the gentleman at the podium, Ken Weissman, back to the Blue Ribbon Task Force process. Ken, do you have any commentary?
Well,
I'm sorry.
First, Commissioner before, because his role is defined, it's just like Cindy said, what is our role? Our role is defined in the legislation. We make the final decision.
Absolutely.
We get to decide who we want to believe and who we don't want to believe, and we make the final decision in spite of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and Ken Weissman and all these constituents.
No question of that.
And I totally agree, Jim. I think out of public process, though, the process that's been set up, unless we have the time to undertake everybody's suggested changes, you know, we put ourselves in a situation where can we do the rest of the work of the state if we undertake everybody's changes? And I'm sure some of the other groups would then pose additional changes that they wanted, that they compromised on, et cetera. I think what I'm asking the Blue Ribbon Task Force to do is to give us a summary report. Were these proposals evaluated? Is the science there? Have some of the allegations that have been made accurate? Is this new information? Is it changed information? Those are the things I guess I'm asking for from the Blue Ribbon Task Force, because I didn't go to all those meetings. I don't know what the stakeholder groups did. I don't know what the department did. And again, ultimately, it is up at this podium that we'll make that decision, and we'll vote however we do. But at least I would like to hear from the initiative process what did occur at the next meeting, I guess, is when we'd be seeking additional information, both from the department and the task force. So.
Well, the problem I have with that is that they're gonna tell you what occurred based on what they heard at the department. And I just got through saying that we had a presentation several years ago asking them not to do their studies on abalone and those high populated areas, and we got testimony that's exactly what they did. So we're not getting. The Blue Ribbon Task Force didn't get the truth.
But I agree with
and
you. Let's find out
for the first time, we're seeing videos that show we said in the very beginning.
Well, I guess, and I don't deny that might be the case, and we need to ask the department, where were the studies done? Did you undertake further studies or just in the high-populated area? So,
If I could make...
Please, Ken.
I think the Blue Ribbon Task Force...
For the record, need
yes,
to.
Ken Weissman, Executive Director of the... California MLPA Blue Ribbon Task Force. The task force was very aware of your role and did not want to suggest that we did it perfectly. We thought what we thought we gave you in the integrated preferred alternative was our best compromise. But we also sent you three other proposals, all that met the guidelines. And most of the things that folks have been talking about here today are, say, either loosen ours a little bit or tighten it up. The all except I believe the moving of the line, the other proposals are all within proposals that are available to you. And it was always our intention that you would have the ability to say, because these other three proposals were all good within the guidelines and we endorsed them, we made a compromise, but we gave you the options then to look at those other three and say, to do your job, that you may be in this kind of a position where you felt you wanted to make a change, we gave you a menu to pull from, higher and lower and in-between protection. So
what you're saying, Ken, if I may, at the risk of interrupting you, is that in your opinion, without delving into it in specifics, in your opinion, then, that which has been asked in terms of line adjustments, boundary adjustments, is in all likelihood embedded within the other proposals or the totality of that which is noticed, which is contemplated to be noticed?
The line adjustment, I don't I don't know for sure whether that's in a specific proposal. Clearly, in 2XA, the ability to have abalone at Saunders Reef, actually that was in 1-3 as well, the ability to have abalone on the Russian River, in Sea Lion Cove is not in one proposal. Those three all give you the options to decide what you want to, because those were all proposals that we thought met the guidelines.
You would need to check on the boundary whether or not the boundary change was in one of those proposals. That's the only one.
Boundary adjustment is not does not show up in any of the options. That's one we would have to make some adjustments.
Okay.
The others, Abalone Saunders Reef, there is in fact one of the other, the X3A option, I believe, has one that allows abalone at Saunders Reef. The line adjustment, we do not believe is in there, so we'd have to make a modification.
And Sankey, do we know for sure on Jenner? Is that?
My problems is I don't know. The commission's only talked about a line boundary change. I'm not going to presume whether you pick up any of these others. You need to tell us whether you're interested in them.
I think this is a good discussion of what our options are for the commission to remind us of. There is some flexibility in those options, and then if a commissioner wants to see a boundary change, that's a whole new item.
Richard.
And that's exactly what we did last time, was we made boundary changes, but later on in this process and really muddied the water, and we're trying to avoid that now.
Well, and Commissioner Colick, because you did that, we wanted to give you those boundary change options in the other three proposals. And I'm not sure on Jenner, because that really we didn't discuss it that much. It was the Russian River on the salmon. But I know some of these other options were forwarded to you, so you would have that option without messing up the
I believe the boundary changes we made last time, though, were already in alternatives that had been presented. They weren't a whole new alternative that hadn't been heard before, if I recall.
Actually, Adrienne is a bit of an expert on this one, because she was the one who did the info. Which is what caught us last time. Yeah, well, hang on just a second. Let's do that. But may I ask the question, Sankey? I'm going to need your.
Sorry, I was conferring with my experts here.
Sankey, if I may. We have enough time to wait until February for some. Pardon? Nothing has been noticed. Yeah. Nothing has been noticed. We have enough time for some background information, investigation, to come to us in February to accomplish perhaps what Jim wants to do or not or whatever, but to encompass that, but be actually in a better technical position so that we understand exactly what we have to do in order to make certain things possible. Is that not true? And I'll get you to say.
No.
No.
No. The
I don't like no's.
I know. There is a but. Just to be clear.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, your most excellent staff is conferring with me. It's a matter of timing and how many discussions you want. If we wait till we have not gone to notice, you have authorized us to get the notice published. We have a draft on our internet. It has not been filed yet at your request. So that has not started the APA clock, therefore. So if you wait till February to make a decision about whether you have the regulatory package you want, there will not be enough time to adopt in April. You'll have to wait till May. If you tell us what options you may want now, we could build those and file that, because I believe you've technically gotten a notice, but your executive director wants to pipe in.
Well, we have not gotten a notice. And the larger question, though, any possible changes added by commissioners, is that within the scope of the environmental document that's being prepared right now?
No.
And if that's not
that's something we don't need it from the audience, please. Let's have everybody let us talk about this.
Yes.
We really appreciate your.
So that's something else.
As staff, depending on what you tell us to do or ask us to consider, we need to go and investigate that properly. I want to make sure I dot my I's and cross my T's. So I kind of, you have the package as presented by the BRTF with the IPA and the three other alternatives. Anything else, we're going to need to do a little bit of homework if you want to consider any alternatives. That means we will not be going to notice until your next meeting or if you have special.
If it's the pleasure of the commission, I'd like to take a five-minute break to let everybody confer, and then we can come back in 5 minutes. Dan?
I have one suggestion so the staff can be thinking about this in the five-minute thing. I think two things are clear to me. Both Jim and Cindy are correct. If the commission, any commissioner, wants to see alternatives discussed as options for us to consider, then this is the time to be bringing that up versus in January or February when we have a set of options only. And so if Jim's talking about and I'm inclined to be supportive of that, a potential line change or opening up some other new areas, different areas to to abalone diving, then we need to direct the staff to give us whatever we need to have to make that option. But I agree with Cindy totally. I think the best thing we could do is have the staff bring that option to us, and that doesn't have to be I don't know when that has to be. We'll have to let the process take that course, whatever the right thing to do is. But I think we should send it back to the BRTF with this group and say, is there any compromise in here that can get everybody happy that fits in with what we've already got? Because my instincts are there probably are. But if we don't give them that opportunity, then we're not giving the process its due consideration, the BRTF's process that they've gone through. I think we've got to say, maybe there was an option here on something that you could make a change on that you can live with and they can live with and we can all move on here without making it a little bigger deal.
That is distinctly possible. It is my understanding of that process is, in fact, that's how we got the IPA. They did, in fact, consider those, and that due process was done. But I don't know that for certain since I was not there, and in deference to your concerns. Why don't we take a five-minute break, if we may, and let staff confer on this. Obviously, we cannot, and we will let a five-minute thing happen while people get their whatever it is together. Okay, thank you for allowing us a technical recess here. We are back in session. We are not going to be, as perhaps you probably surmise, taking any further public testimony on that. We are done with public testimony. Just for today, there'll be a lot of opportunity to take public testimony going forward. From the legal perspective of what we can do today, Deborah, would you like to make a few comments, which is really what we were trying to figure out as to what's the legal niceties of the things that we have to do?
Certainly. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General. In terms of item 11, I think as we briefly stated before, it's notice for an informational update. There is no notice in the agenda for any type of action item, such as a motion or a vote or a change from the direction that was given to staff back in the October meeting in Santa Rosa when this item was when direction was given to staff to notice this with the three options, I believe, that were currently in place at that time. That doesn't mean that, was it five options, Adriana? Thank you. Thank you. In any event, what the commission could do today, if it so chose, since it is an informational item, if you wish to seek additional information from any of the stakeholders, from the department, from whomever, you certainly are free to do so, and you don't need a motion or really it's not really an action item, it's just seeking information. However, if you wanted to give the staff direction different from that you gave them in October in Santa Rosa, that would have to be agendized as a possible action item, and that could happen at your next meeting. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yes, any other questions on that particular issue? Okay. There is one other question that I would like to ask Ken Weissman, if you would come to the podium. And that is, it is my understanding that the North Coast Blue Ribbon Task Force is now officially disbanded.
Correct.
That is correct. That was my question. Okay, thank you. Yes, please.
I just wanted to make sure that I'd answer the commissioner's questions in terms of any legal issues and how to proceed this morning.
Yes, I mean, my questions are answered. And then my question to staff with the department and our staff is, based on our October recommendation, when were we going to move forward with the eyesore and notification? What sort of timeline? I mean, the issues that are raised today are completely changes. If they're not in any of those alternatives and weren't brought to us in any other format, looking at another alternative delays that process. So I want to understand the timelines on that for the public record.
Well, at this point, we have not gone to notice, and part of that was the potential delays in the environmental document that we had been hearing about. If we go to notice after this meeting, if the commission gives us that guidance, we could have a public testimony in February. It sounds like it's not likely that we would have possible adoption or a CEQA document ready in March, so we could do public testimony in March and notice that it will be possible adoption in April. Those are still – April potentially is risky is my understanding, unless you guys feel
– But I want to go back for a minute. Other than the changes that were kind of dropped on us today, potential changes and ideas, had we not – I mean, this was an information item. We were talking about a timeline. We would have been going to notice in February.
That was going to notice in February was still up in the air based on the CEQA document delay.
On the CEQA document,
right.
But not on any other alternative changes and
right,
other issues.
So the direction that you provided us 2 months ago
right.
still stands. So we have a draft notice that is posted on the department's website and on our website, which does not include the recommendations or requests that you heard today. So part of what we'd like to do is ask the department and the task force to both provide you with more information for February, agendize an action item to amend that draft notice to include these recommendations, and which mean we wouldn't file that until after your February meeting.
Well, I don't know that you're going to have majority votes to do that, and I don't want to delay the rest of the process. We made a decision in October that allowed us quite a bit of compromise and latitude within those options to take public testimony and to amend. Now, some of the suggestions today weren't even within those and didn't come through any sort of public process. So that I have a real issue with. I don't have a real issue with what we decided in October and moving forward with that. Notice having that latitude to look for additional compromise in some of these areas. But I don't want staff to have and the department to have any ambiguity in what we as a full commission decided in October, holding off doing anything until February for further direction because this commission can't act today on this item. So I know that's as clear as mud, but...
Well, let me try to clarify a little bit. If we go forward and staff publishes notice and publishes that our first public testimony for the regulatory item is February, that agenda item as it stands will still be room, and I'm double-checking with our attorney, there will still be room if the commissioners want to make some motions and potential changes to the eyesore at that time. So we wouldn't need an additional potential action item agenda item if we went forward with public testimony starting, continuing the official regulatory public testimony. There's room within that agenda item for potential action amongst the commissioners. Is that correct? So if you direct staff to go ahead and publish notice, what we could do is say public testimony February, public testimony March, possible adoption April.
But when you're saying that there's room for change in that that's only within the documents that we forwarded in October?
If you wanted to go outside, no. If you want, there's an option to go outside. It would then require further comment period. So there's always that option to make some changes.
It's usually about a 45-day delay.
If it's a significant change, it's an additional 45 days added to the public.
The only thing that I'm hearing Jim talk about right now is the line change. That's the only thing that's not in the documents we have right now.
No, actually, Adriana, you might.
No, actually, from Jim Martin, what we heard today and what we've received in writing, there are several requests, none of which are covered in any of your five options.
So the moving of the line and varying
degrees. It's more complicated, Dan.
I need to look at it more specifically, but I do know that it is not contained in the documents that you've authorized staff to notice now. That does not preclude you from adding it.
Yeah, why wouldn't we do it now? Do it now or do it in February? Seems
today's agenda item does not allow for action, it can't be done today.
I understand that. Direct staff to come back to us in February with that as an option, which we can then incorporate into it? They can then have the environmental documents. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be incorporated, but as an option to look at. Why wouldn't we direct them to do that? That's just directing staff. That's not a motion here.
If I can understand what you're asking, today's agenda item is for information only. I think that there's a good argument that if you were to direct staff to change the ISOR, put out the ISOR with an additional option, that is an action item.
I didn't say put it out. I said bring it back to us. I'm not saying publish it or anything else, but just saying, look, we'd like to consider this as part of the process. Can you bring that back to us at our next meeting so that we can then look at that when we're going to do so? And then the notice period may have to be changed because it's something new, and I know all that, but we're not going to waste this time period.
I think that one way you could approach that is to have this. You really can't change the direction you've given staff back in October in Santa Rosa on this item, and that would need to go forward. If you wanted to get information for an additional option to be presented for consideration for your February meeting, I see nothing that precludes you from doing so. However, depending on if the option is a new option that isn't contemplated within the original notice, that option would need to go out for a 45-day notice period. If it is contemplated within the options, which I'm hearing it may not be, but if it were, then it's an additional 15-day notice period.
I get it and agree. It seems like we're going to save a lot of time, at least have the option so we can move this all forward. Otherwise, we're going to get delayed, pretty clear. I don't know that that serves any purpose.
Right. And I guess, you know, here's a couple messages I want to send to the constituents out there. First off, had staff had this or known that this presentation was happening before this morning, perhaps we could have had more answers and discussion on this prior, so we wouldn't be doing this now. What's the message to every other constituent group every other time? We just made a decision in October. Within that, we left ourselves latitude to make some of the changes that would have accommodated some of these folks. But now we've got a whole new option presented directly to us that circumvented the entire process. And I guess I haven't heard testimony that tells me why this is new information, why it wasn't considered during the additional process, and what this is going to mean to the future of our process.
There's another problem.
I have no problem compromising within these alternatives, but that's what the March or the October meeting was, with everybody in Santa Rosa, all sides represented, testifying before us. And now one group comes forward under an item that's just information only, and now we're going to send everybody, and we're going to hear hours and hours of testimony on this issue, no doubt. We're going to spend a huge amount of time in February just based on this, and I'm just not sure that's the best use of public process.
I think there's another problem with this. It's not that I'm suspicious of the efficacy of what they're talking about. It's that I'm suspicious of this with respect to my sense of process. I believe that if the general public and those involved with the BRTF process had known that we might be doing something like this today, that we would have heard not one group of speakers, but probably a half a dozen group of speakers, each one of whom having their own particular set of ideas.
Haven't we already heard that? Didn't we have the seaweed guy come in? And we have all kinds of people come in all the time that keep proposals.
And we acted on that back when that all happened.
As we would could do today. I mean, I think the process is public comment. They got to keep coming until we shut them off.
If I may, I would like to remind everyone that these the recommendations that you heard today have not changed from the recommendations that you heard on the day when you made your motion.
That's correct.
To authorize staff to publish notice of the options that were promoted up from the BRTF. So that has not changed, and you did make a decision there. And I just want to note that there has not been a change in what the groups are requesting at this time.
They just did it again. So, with more detail. So, John.
Well, what I'd like from the commissioners is a sense or some guidance. I'm not asking for an official vote or motion, but as staff,
which we cannot do.
Right, as staff, we are still holding off on publishing the notice that you authorized us to publish in October, based on the information that we have a significant delay in the environmental document. The regulations cannot be adopted until that environmental document is finalized and certified by the commission. So, moving forward with that being delayed is premature. So, what we could do as staff is, if you want to go with this, it's a slight risk that it'll be ready for the April adoption, that environmental document. But we could move forward and put out to notice public comment February, public comment March, possible adoption April. We could also move it even further, possible adoption May. We could do public comment March, public comment April, possible adoption May, and not have public comment in February. We're only required to have one more public comment and one possible adoption meeting based on Office of Administrative Law and APA rules. So, we don't even have to decide that at this point. We could move it off into February also.
Okay.
Well, I think we need to hear from Commissioner Kellogg on what his suggestions are to the commission, and then I'll have. Jim, you asked for this, so I guess I'm looking to you. Are these the changes that you want to see published? You want to see us bring this back in February for a change of direction?
Personally, I want to get it right when we get it done. If it takes longer to do it right, then it takes longer. Last time we had to have all those public hearings and went through it, and if that's what's necessary, I'm ready to do it again.
Let me make a comment here. I agree with you entirely, but I may have a slightly different perspective with the importance of the type of thing to get right. To me, the type of thing that we have to get right is the process. Where the line stands in a particular cove from a biological perspective is, in my opinion, already been considered from what I understand about the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the RSJs and all the work that they did, as you know, probably tens of thousands of hours of work. I do not want to do anything today or tomorrow or any other time that risks that process, that would in any way insult those who have literally dedicated hundreds of man hours themselves to being involved in something, thinking that a decision tree was in place, and it turns out that perhaps that was not, and that perhaps other people who could have, if that was still an open question at this point, could have made further commentary and perhaps brought us to a different perspective. So being someone who really believes in process, I really am immensely reluctant to change the process at this point, and I view information coming in at this later date in the process as inappropriate, and I'm not suggesting in any way that I, because I have immense respect for the people who brought the information today, or at least the vast majority of them that I know, and I'm not suggesting they did it on purpose or that they have some malevolent intentions or anything like that. They have an intense feeling about something, and they wish to bring it to us. And I respect that. So does everyone else. And I believe that if you indeed respect process, everyone else, therefore, had to have their best shot at it. And I believe that that was done within the context of the BRTF. So I'm not prepared to entertain anything additional going forward.
And I would tend to agree, because I do think, Jim, we heard some of these issues, maybe not in the full detail in October when the full commission was here and made a decision to move forward. Certainly we provided more opportunity today. I don't know that there's any more information that would persuade me to change anything. And outside of the alternatives that we've already talked about that give us some latitude to make some changes, so... But, this is really out of context because we had this item on the agenda, and perhaps we shouldn't have had it on the agenda if we can't take action on it anyway. It's just frustrating to everybody.
John, you have a few comments you want to make, or anyone else?
Well, from a staff perspective and for the February agenda, I'm still hoping to get some guidance, and Deb, correct me if I'm wrong, but I can get general guidance without a motion and a vote from the commission on whether we should still hold the draft regulatory proposal. You already voted for us to go to notice, but staff has been holding it, like I said, because of the delays on the environmental document. If I can get some direction on that today on whether we should go forward, put a notice, and have an officially noticed public comment period on the proposed regulations at the February meeting. Another alternative would be to still hold that off till we get further clarification and crystallization on when this environmental document might be ready. And at the February meeting, it's possible to put an agenda item similar to this, but maybe more adequately worded to allow some further action by the commission and further direction on the future eyesore and noticing.
There, if I may, there's just one additional item I think to consider in terms of your timing. If the commission were at the February meeting desired to put out an additional option or alternative, you would have to ensure that the CEQA document reflected that, an analysis of that option or alternative. So that may or may not play into the timing of a CEQA document that's necessary for the final adoption of any regulatory package. I was just going to suggest also that, again, you really, I don't believe, are in a position to change the direction that that was given to the staff about the eyesore and the notice back in October. But as we've discussed, you certainly are in a position to ask for information to be presented to you at your February meeting for whatever consideration is properly noticed and what you think is appropriate.
Adriana, as someone who has been intimately involved in the process part of this thing, what is your commentary on that remark?
Well, I think there is an iteration of the recommendation that you, or the request that you received today, that is represented by the package 2XA, which you did direct staff to notice for as an option for you. So it actually gives you a little more leeway than what they're asking for today. So you're not precluded from making or not making a decision regarding these specific areas. And at any time, you can authorize staff to make a change to what you've noticed.
Okay.
So At this point, I'm as your staff understanding that your last motion stands, and we can consider this further for additional or different action in February.
Well, I think that's clear. We can't take action today, so staff is going to proceed with what we decided in October. If in February there are votes of the commission to change what we're going to do, then we're going to re-notice and take additional publish another notification and go through the process. In the meantime, the questions I think Jim asked for additional information on, and I asked the department as to the transects that were part of the abalone. Sankey's talking over there. I think there was some information, clarification points, and process points that we would like more information on as it's relevant to this. But otherwise, we're proceeding based on the commission's last action until the February meeting, at which time some or other commissioners might vote differently. So.
Okay, and also, at this moment, before anyone else says anything else, I have received a request for a five-minute recess from another commissioner, and it is the custom of the commission to honor those requests, so we stand in recess for 5 minutes.
You know, based on all of our discussions, my sense is that based on the October direction to the commission, to the staff, you authorized to go to notice. If staff publishes notice with the proposed eyesore that has been on the web for a couple of months now, if we go with February as public comment, March as public comment, April as possible adoption, if we want a little more room on the environmental document, we could go with May as a possible adoption. You know, I've given up gambling, so I don't know what to tell you between April and May, but it sounds like April is not a sure thing. So if you want to be very comfortable, I would say possible adoption May. If you want to push it a little bit, we'd say possible adoption April. And we can always change those down the line, but then we would have to do a re-notice, which could cost thousands of dollars in effort.
Well, given that we have no budget, I think it probably should be the consensus that we go for May.
If we go to May, that possible adoption is in Upland. If we go possible adoption in April, it's in Crescent City.
I think May's better anyway in that regard.
Yeah, the Upland meeting location is like almost right next door to the Ontario Airport compared to Crescent City.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, this is an exceptionally technical.
Yeah. And
event,
I want to ask our OAL expert, and I know she doesn't like to speak on the microphone, but I've asked this before and I want to ask one more time. Can you, by law, put out a public notice that gives two possible adoption dates, or do you have to single it down to one?
We've never done one with two possible adoption dates. We would have to re-notice specifying which one of those, I believe.
So
what we can do, commissioners, is double check with Office of Administrative Law, and if they allow the possibility of two adoption dates, I would suggest.
We really want to bother with that? Why don't we just say May?
Okay, I'm fine with that.
Let's just take all the question off the table.
So then
May.
That would if then we would have three public comments: February, March, and April, and then possible adoption in May.
Well, given the nature of the concern with respect to the specificity of these packages, I think an additional month of public comment is not a bad idea.
So I got that sense. I'll go forward. Staff will go forward with that then.
Okay. Any further commentary or questions?
Well, I think there was additional information that the commissioners were talking about needing to make a decision in February if they want to change anything as it relates to the environmental document and the options we're looking at. And so I think we need to be very clear on what that additional information is. I know for one, there were allegations made, and I think least one commissioner thought it was accurate of testimony related to what was what the transects were in that intertidal area as well as the deeper area with the abalone. And I asked Sankey to bring back to evaluate what was done and to give us another presentation on this, on that part of it. I don't know what other commissioners want to hear as it relates to what was proposed today.
Well, we do have that request, and Sankey acceded to that. Is there any other specific information that anyone was interested in?
Well, I think also an evaluation of the possible additional option that Commissioner Kellogg asked for, the line change. What would that entail? Would that entail an environmental document change? Would that entail if another 45 days? Just so the commissioners know, I think the answer on the 45 days, we already know that, but what else might that require? And that could be discussed in February, and
no need
the commissioners consider it.
Right. So to be clear, you would ask us to evaluate
Jim and
Milo's requested changes, the feasibility to you in February.
Right.
I got that.
But just that?
Yes.
Just that. There was also additional economic data that people have alleged is new data, and as it relates to, and I think Dan Wolford presented this, he was in a separate packet. I just want to make sure that staff and the initiative staff can respond to what the stakeholder groups saw or knew in their economic data.
Yeah, just to be clear, the department does not have any economic data additional to evaluate. Initiative. Yeah, I just want to make sure
the
you understand.
Initiative.
No, you just say what you say.
Right. We'll bring our scientific data.
And I look at the department, but it's our staff as well to put together the responses to what stakeholders are saying is new information. Let's make sure we have responses from the initiative process.
And I hope, Cindy, to have all of that information chronicled in a memo from the task force and their staff to you so that you know exactly what was considered and what the department presented, and it's all laid out in front of you, so you have that to contemplate further.
Now, in preparation for February, I think the commissioners are wise enough to know that we've just opened up probably an 8 or 12-hour public hearing as it relates to this item, and I think we need to be clear what other business items we have for the state's resources and make sure that we have agendized adequate time at that February meeting to go through this, because we're going to need to allow everybody's presentations, and it's going to be a lengthy process, I assume, that there's many stakeholders in the audience who
that
want
meeting
equal
is going
time.
To be right here in
yes.
this auditorium.
Actually, I'm not sure it's in this auditorium. Do we? East End Complex in Sacramento will have the specific address.
Well, may I point out that the location of that particular venue needs to anticipate.
I think it is a large room.
What we have just done to ourselves.
I want to make sure that we allow or give the public an indication of how much time we're going to spend on this, because if right off the bat there's a majority of the commission that are not willing to entertain huge amounts of information on this, then maybe it can be limited. I don't know that I'm comfortable reopening this whole process of what we spent time in October deciding. So,
well, and meaning no disrespect to virtually anyone at all, I am extremely uncomfortable reopening the process. Having been a person who has lived through the other MLPA adoption and the Sturm und Drang and even rather violent emotions that fell out of that, I'm just really not interested in doing that. And it's not that I'm skittish about taking personal pain. That's okay. That's not the problem. The problem is that I don't mean to reiterate, but I believe that the process has already adequately considered these issues, and so this would be not only a replication, but in my opinion would be a breach of the process.
Well, we'll do it then.
But we will do it then. So.
Well, and I'd like to add, in February you do have a full calendar of things that you are required
to. You mean used
to
have a full calendar
check
of
out.
Other things that we were going to do. Okay. Yes, I know.
Move on to item 12.
I think that's a good idea.
Item 12, pursuant to Fish and Game Code Sections 2075 and 2075.5, consideration and possible action on the petition and the department's one-year status report slash recommendation on the petition to delist the American peregrine falcon and adoption of commission findings.
I have a feeling this is going to be a lot more fun.
Dr. Eric Loft, Wildlife Branch.
Good morning, everyone. President Rogers, commissioners, yes, I'm going to derail the process of what you've been going on the past two items and talk to you about something that we think is a very positive example. Thanks. The slides are already up. About a year ago, a little over a year ago, you made a decision to go to status review on the peregrine falcon on a petition to delist the falcon. It was a petition submitted by Mr. Gary Alton. And we went through that petition review. Here in the audience with me is Leanne Komrak. She was the lead author out of the Wildlife Branch on that status review that we did. Compliments to Leanne for a fine job, and Randy Logsdon for her participation in developing that as well. So the petition action was to delist the peregrine falcon from the California Endangered Species Act. And just in a nutshell, we recommend that the peregrine has recovered in California and that it be removed from the California Endangered Species List. The timeline for how some of these events took place: federal endangered, state fully protected, state endangered by particular years. In 1971, when it became state endangered, that was a process where a lot of species, as you know, were largely grandfathered in on a less rigorous course of action that currently takes place. And then, of course, 2007, a candidate for delisting. 1999, the federal government delisted the species as well. Four key factors that we'd point out in the status review leading to the listing that happened was, of course, DDT. It's banned since 1972 in the United States. Has, of course, been a big reason for improvement in seabirds' survival because of potential issues that had with egg thinning and reproductive failure that occurred. Same kind of deal with pelicans and other species, to my understanding. So as a consequence of a lot of that, the population had declined. Also, the range had been reduced substantially, and some of the few remaining sites were being disturbed and or vandalized by humans. So we're on to managing towards recovery, and there has been, over the years, a successful breeding and reintroduction program. Santa Cruz Predatory Bird Research Group, and in particular, a gentleman who has recently passed away, Brian Walton, I think is noticed in our document as being sort of a lead on all that. There. Didn't get it back. Wow, we had a power outage.
I guess there are no more falcons.
Is it out?
I'm sorry.
Is it out up there, too?
We're going to have to relist.
Anyway, I'll continue on. I actually have some notes. Currently, there had been over 800 peregrines released in California through the program, and there have been several protective measures that have been taken, including acquisitions through the Wildlife Conservation Board of ecological reserves and such to specifically protect peregrine nesting sites. Historically, there had been 100 to 300 active pairs. During the 70s, it was down to about 20 to 40, and currently, right now, the estimate is about 215 to 250 or so active breeding pairs of peregrine in the state, which to us is evidence of population recovery. And again, another thing that is of benefit is the mean annual productivity has increased substantially currently compared to past years.
Okay, status light just changed on that center.
I'll just do a couple more thoughts here. The range, it's almost reoccupied all of its historic range statewide, except for perhaps the far northeastern part of the state. And we do, in our status review, talk about and discuss some of the long-term management issues that exist. There still is some concern about contaminants in the environment, not so much DDT, but perhaps new and other things that are out there. Obviously, habitat degradation for all wildlife species, not just peregrine. There's still some issues related to human disturbance, collisions with power lines, and they run into buildings because they do such crazy things. And then there's also actually some management conflicts with peregrine and other sensitive species, least terns, snowy plovers, where the peregrines prey on those particular species. You have slides again. Let me just, there's the range. Some of the long-term management issues, least tern. So our key findings out of the report that our ecosystems in California are recovering from the DDT ban, but there still remains some hot spots that are an issue as it relates to contaminants. The peregrine population has rebounded, and most of the historic range has been reoccupied by peregrine. Captive breeding program and reintroduction has been very successful for peregrines. Another finding is the federal government, as a result of their delisting, are doing supporting monitoring only through 2015. The department, we'd recommend a longer period of monitoring through 2025. The fully protected status remains for the peregrine as it would for the, or did and does for the brown pelican through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Our recommendations thus then are that the contaminants in the environment continue to be monitored, monitor eggshell thickness, continue population monitoring, like I said, until 2025, continue to protect nesting sites, that we minimize conflicts with other sensitive species. We're working to try to do that, like I said, with the snowy plover, the least tern. And that's it. If you have questions that are more complex than is there a raptor, I'll refer to Leanne. So,
I have a question on the delisting. You're suggesting a delisting, but they would retain a fully protected status. Tell me what the difference is, please.
Where's my technical? Do you know what that is, Sonky?
Yeah,
there's my technical
that.
Guy.
Yeah, the legislature established a classification called fully protected animals. You have no authority to change that list. The peregrine falcon is one of many listed as fully protected, which means no take at all. So you can certainly remove it from the endangered species list, but you cannot remove it from the fully protected list.
Nor was I suggesting to. I just want to understand what it is.
Yeah, it's a list of critters back. The fully protected predates the CESA, and the otter was added on. There are a whole bunch of species that were added on at the time that felt needed full protection.
It's actually something species that probably doesn't have any real value at this point, you know, because of things that have become much more sophisticated later on, but
well,
is what it is.
It's terrific that as we put things on, we'll take them off as well, so and congratulations to the department and all those involved. I'm sure it's been a long and arduous process to get them back to a recovered status. That's terrific.
And final thoughts, we are working on the CEQA documentation for this and would bring that to you here in the future.
Thank you. Any commentary? Right now we do have some public comments.
Yeah, we have four speaker cards. 3 minutes each, please. Sandy Doy Vetter, Dr. Bill Ferrier, Glenn Stewart, and Walt Manzel. Please line up along the wall.
Turn around, put your hands up.
We'll pull out the executive Uzis. Director did not say up against the wall. He did not say that. Chief Foley might, but we don't. No.
I'd like to thank President Rogers and Executive Director Carlson and this honorable commission for allowing the public an opportunity to speak regarding the delisting of the peregrine falcon. We drove up from San Diego last night on a beautiful day. It was gorgeous to see the beautiful state of California. My name is Sandy Duvetter. I'm a native of California. I was born in Upland, California. I am the executive producer and host of Travel Talk Radio and Travel Talk Television. We celebrate travel, and of course, nature is a very big part of what we do. I'm here to represent Gary Alton. Gary Alton is the author of the petition to delist the peregrine falcon. He is somebody I've known my whole life. We went to the same elementary school, the same high school. When he came back after college, he started teaching biology at our high school, Chafee, in Ontario. And he is truly a lover of all animals, and especially the hawks and falcons of the world.
You know, I'm really delighted to meet someone who can speak and is educated from upland in Ontario. That's that's just terrific.
It's up to you, Daniel, to take over on that one. Gary has always, as I mentioned, loved wildlife, and his dedication to biology as a high school teacher has been evident for 30 years. He and his brother Ron attended the 1999 delisting of the federal delisting of the peregrine falcon, and this turned into a story of the American way and democracy, how it works. When you consider Gary, a high school teacher, high school biology teacher, took it upon himself to write this petition, which he successfully succeeded in doing in 2007. Gary was diagnosed with cancer in February. And excuse me for a second here. He also married my niece, Cindy, and they've been married for 30 years. They have no children, and this is really everything to Gary. He's been diagnosed with cancer in February, and I offered my services to put his website of the petition of the peregrine falcon on the online. And for the record, it's at celestiallink.com/peregrine_falcon. I have business cards with that whole address on there for you. Gary's present day condition is very grave. We saw him again yesterday. He's been taken home from the hospital. He's on hospice. He's on methadone every 4 hours. But the only thing, and it's very interesting for Cindy and ourselves to see, that the spark in his eye is still there for the bird. And when I told him I was coming up here to speak on his part, he cried, and he had that little spark in his eyes. We didn't think he would last till the 12th, but every day he asked Cindy what day it is, and we know that he's looking for this. This is an emotional plea, I see that, but it is really about making the right choice, and we believe this is the right choice for this bird to be delisted, and we do implore you to look at this today. If you're thinking about doing it, please do it today so that we can tell Gary that it's been done. Anyway, I want to just say, too, that this week he was given the Alton Award, honoring outstanding individual accomplishments that advance the art and sport of falconry in the state of California, named in recognition of its first recipient. And this is for Gary Alton. So anyway, thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm so tearful. But he's such an incredible guy. You'd understand. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bitter.
Dr. Bill Ferrier, Glenn Stewart, Walt Manzel.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm Dr. Bill Ferrier, University of California, Davis. I'm the director of the California Raptor Center. I'm pleased to be here. I'm going to be very brief. I've studied peregrine falcons most of my life, and I'm here to support the petition and I can tell you that through the years, I've watched peregrines since the early 70s, and now when I'm out bird watching and out in the local area here, I see peregrines almost daily. They're there, the recovery is complete, and what this really is a wonderful celebration of teamwork between what's happened with the listing, the California Fish and Game, and the raptor enthusiasts that have released thousands of birds throughout the United States. And so the recovery is complete, and I in complete support of the petition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next. Glenn Stewart, followed by Walt Manzel.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Stewart. I'm coordinator of the Predatory Bird Research Group at UC Santa Cruz. I'm happy to be here today to speak in support of Gary's petition. As you know, and was noted earlier, the Predatory Bird Group played a key role in the recovery of the peregrine falcon, and I worked with Brian Walton, who was the first coordinator
of the group. Many of the people in this room, or some of you, knew Ryan Walton. It trusted his judgment when it came to Peregrine Falcon recovery and management issues in the 1970s, 80s, and 1990s. I talked to Brian about Gary Alton's petition a month or so before Brian passed away suddenly. And I can tell you two things that I remember vividly about that conversation. He thought that Gary did a scholarly job on the petition, and he fully supported delisting, and I do too. Both Brian and I came to conservation biology because of our experience as young falconers, admiring these birds, and both of us focused our careers on threatened and endangered species of raptors because we care deeply about these birds. Brian worked principally on the peregrine falcon recovery while I worked on the Harris hawk recovery in southeastern California and bald eagle recovery in central California, principally out of Big Sur. But always with a strong interest in the progress of the peregrine work. For the past decade, I've been focused on the safe release of young peregrines that we collect from bridges and other unsafe nest sites. The UC Santa Cruz Predatory Bird Research Group has been very happy to cooperate with the department, with staff members during the past year who have done a fine job of assembling the most current information that we and others have on the California peregrine falcon population. More peregrine falcon nest sites are known in California today than at any time in history. We estimate there are at least 233 pairs in the state, up from just two known pairs in 1970. No financial support exists today for rigorous annual nesting surveys, but all indications point to a robust population that continues to expand. And I'd like to add that as we go forward to 2015 and doing monitoring, that the Predatory Bird Group will be happy to assist the department with voluntary surveys just to try and keep tabs on this population as it grows. And we're working to train people to do that sort of work according to our protocol. As I mentioned, we provided our data to the department for its analysis. It's an excellent analysis. It contains much of what we've found over the past three decades on peregrines. I brought just one slide with me today, and I'm not sure if we can throw that up there or not at this point. And then can I use this for a pointer? There it is. We're looking at the Bay Area, of course, the San Francisco Bay Area. If I brought a slide of the entire state and the entire population, it would be obliterated with dots. And I'll just make this point briefly that helps to illustrate where we're at with the population. This is the San Francisco Bay Area. It includes 20 peregrine falcon nest sites in the Bay Area. We've got Mount Diablo over here, the Antioch Bridge. I draw your attention to this nest site right here, which is along Highway 101. It is a 60-foot-tall bridge that crosses Richardson Bay near Tiburon. Here is probably one of the most marginal sites you'll ever find for peregrine falcons. But my point is that they're adopting places like this because all the good places are taken. We have today a robust, very well-recovered peregrine falcon population in the state. And I know I speak for many state and federal biologists, for people in the nonprofit sector, such as the Audubon Society's chapters all over the state, and people from all walks of life who volunteered time, money, personal effort on behalf of the peregrine falcon. And I think it's time to celebrate this great accomplishment that we've all participated in. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you for all your help and leadership there. It's terrific. That's a great story.
Thank you.
Walt Mansell, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. I must take a claim of precedence. I spent time in the 1960s guarding the peregrine nest on Morro Rock as a game warden, a young rookie game warden, and learning about peregrines. We fully support delisting where the science shows this, and it's not something based on emotionalism or fable or smoke and mirrors, and I think it my applause and good thoughts go to all that were involved in this process, and we do support the petition to delist.
Thank you, Will. Okay, now that's our last public speaker. Any commentary? Any discussion? Jim?
I'm just ready to make the staff recommended motion.
Please.
Someone
read the motion?
Yep, I'll have just a motion. And, well, do you want that on the screen during the motion?
Yeah, I had just suggested that there's an award that was presented to Gary, and in Gary's honor, if we could show that award while the motion is being made, and you pass on our words to Gary for that.
Sure.
Well,
yeah, maybe we need to turn it.
Is there a way?
Yeah, there we go. Other way. There you go.
There we go. Perfect. A little higher.
A little higher.
There.
Excellent.
There you go.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Read the motion.
Suggested motion from staff, the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the provisions of Section 2075 and 2075.5 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement or interpret or make specific said section of said code, hereby finds that the information contained in the petition to delist the American peregrine falcon from the endangered species status warrants delisting.
Do I hear that motion?
I'll move.
A little bit more, sorry. And therefore, direct staff to publish notice of intent to amend regulations, possible action scheduled for February 09 meeting.
Do I hear that motion?
So I'll move.
I'll second.
Second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Unanimous. Gary, I hope you are watching this broadcast or can get access to this broadcast. What we did today was in your hands. Well done.
Item 13, discussion of 09 regulatory calendar and possible regulatory proposals. No public speaker cards. We're going to put something up on the screen. John, were we putting something on the screen on this, or is it just? Oh, I think you were going to introduce this.
Sorry for the delay. Sankey may want to add a little bit to this, but commissioners, if you recall, we came before you a couple of meetings ago to talk about the regulatory proposals for 2009. We've submitted or solicited recommendations from the department, which the department has prepared and submitted to us. We're compiling those now and trying to put them all together into one rather large package that will be included in your binders for the next year. And I guess we really want to give you just a progress report to that effect and kind of a last call for any other recommended items. I know Commissioner Gustafson, you asked for, I think it was two items at the last commission meeting, and I think both of them dealt with fees. Was that right, Sankey? And I think those are in that package. We understand that there will be other regulations that may come up and be necessary during the year, but this is kind of a planning thing to let commissioners know, to help the department plan, and also to inform the public about. So, Sankey, anything you want to add to that?
Yes, there are two items I want to draw to your attention that will, we hope, affect the 09 rulemaking calendar. As you've probably heard already, as part of a settlement on the condor lead ban lawsuit, the department had agreed as part of that settlement to bring before the commission for your consideration the banning lead for the use while hunting rabbits and squirrels as part of that settlement. It's just our obligation is simply to present it to you. So we would ask permission to bring that forward during the small mammal regulations as one of the regulatory packages. And then the other item, of course, based on testimony yesterday on the halibut trawl gear, is whether you want us to add action on the halibut trawl gear for 092. We just need direction whether to add that.
Commentary from our I think it's the consensus of the...
Yeah, on the halibut trawl, for sure.
For sure.
Well, we have to bring... We're going to look at the other anyway, as a matter of course of business, right? The lead ban on the small game sets.
Right.
And you don't really need much direction on that, contrary to the news releases out there.
Yeah, there's no obligation. It's just we need to bring it to you, and I don't want you to be surprised when it shows up.
We'll be shocked.
Yeah.
I do try no surprises.
Sonky, do what you're supposed to do.
Right. Thanks for reminding us.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you. We have no public speaker cards on this.
Number 14,
discussion and possible adoption of the proposed changes to Section 300, Title 14, CCR, related to early spring apprentice turkey hunt. Eric Loft. And we do have a few speaker cards on this one.
Thanks again, Commissioners. Eric Loft, Wildlife Branch. The proposal before you on this item is the early spring weekend before opportunity that was proposed by the public input, and the department has been working on that, fully supports the notion of having a couple of days the week before the general season opens in the spring for the apprentice turkey hunters to go ahead and hunt. And good opportunity. We support that. I've prepared all that for you. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions or comments of Eric? Public speakers?
Ryan Mathis, Tom Doctor, Bill Gaines, Walt Manziel. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes or less.
Mathis is not here. Whoop, he is. Here we go.
President Rogers and members of the Commission, my name is Ryan Mathis. I'm a regional wildlife biologist for the National Wild Turkey Federation. I'd like to start by thanking the Commission for all your efforts to add this additional two-day youth season to the spring 2009 turkey season. I certainly appreciate the efforts of the department, Dr. Loft and Tom Blankenship, to make this happen. Thank you so much for your support on this important issue. I am in full support of the proposed change to subsection 300, Title 14, and I respectfully ask that you adopt that change today. This additional season will not only provide additional hunting opportunities for young hunters and encourage new hunter recruitment, but it will help promote turkey hunting traditions in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Tom Doctor, Bill Gaines, Walt Manziel.
Good morning. My name is Tom Doctor. I sit on the State Board of Directors for the National Wild Turkey Federation for California, and I'm here to urge my support. I'm supportive of these additional 2 days for our juniors. The way the world is today, and there are so many things that occupy their time, we'd like to see them have good, wholesome hunting abilities in their lives once again, and we thank you for that.
Bill Gaines, Walt Manziel.
Members of the Commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. You've heard me speak on this topic numerous times. I won't be redundant, but I would like to thank the Commission and the department staff for moving forward with our request and the request of the National Wild Turkey Federation for this youth apprentice turkey season. It's the right move, and we greatly appreciate your efforts to get it done. We strongly support it.
Thank you, Bill.
Walt Manziel.
CRPA fully supports this proposal, and we look kindly upon other proposals for more apprentice hunts. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Ed Worley.
Mr. Chairman, Commission members, thank you very much for letting me speak. I want to thank you for all your hard work in opening up the season more and providing more opportunity for everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. That's it?
I believe that's all public comment on this one.
Okay. Any discussion?
I'm prepared to make the suggested staff motion.
Please do.
Suggested motion by Staff Fish and Game Commission pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 200,
and other sections listed in your text for the agenda analysis of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific sections 200 plus other sections in your analysis of the Fish and Game Code, hereby amend subsection 300A1G, Title 14, CCR, related to upland game birds, wild turkeys.
Do I hear that motion? I'll move. Second?
I'll second.
Okay. Any further discussion?
I just have one question. The first speaker said making the changes to the 99 regulations. I assume that this is 99 going forward. It's not a one-time change. This is we're changing the regulations to allow the hunt on a permanent basis until
it's
changed further.
09 regulations, and it will be in effect until you change it otherwise.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Thanks.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous? Item 15.
Item 15, consideration of amendment of Commission's policy on wild trout waters to add Long Lake from Plumas County and Upper Piru, Ventura County. We have Roger Bloom, senior fisheries biologist with the department, to give a presentation.
Good afternoon, commissioners and commission staff. Roger Bloom, fisheries branch. As John was alluding to, I'm going to give a presentation today on proposed waters for designation, including a brief overview. I'll be as quick as possible. I know we want to get out to lunch. On the wild trout program for potentially some commissioners that aren't familiar with the program, and also an update on some legislative changes that happened in 2007 that have a bearing on how we designate and bring waters forward to the commission. So starting off with this slide, this is a flagship water for the wild trout program, Hat Creek in Northern California Region 1. The mission statement of the wild trout program is pretty simple. It's basically to protect and enhance California heritage and wild trout resources while providing high-quality wild trout angling experiences, making fishing better and protecting the resource. There's sometimes some confusions about terminology about heritage and wild trout and native trout, even within our department, especially in the constituency. So I like to clear that up up front. A native trout is a trout that existed in California in prehistoric times. It's also interchangeable with a heritage trout. So when I use those two terms, understand that. A wild trout is born in the wild and completes its entire life cycle in the wild. So there is some times when, let's say, a hatchery fish may reproduce, its progeny can be wild trout. So sometimes that's confusing for some folks, too. But the take-home message is a wild trout can be native or non-native, and it can also be the progeny of hatchery fish. The five key components of the Heritage and Wild Trout Program are basic resource assessment and monitoring, management and planning, habitat restoration, protecting what we have out there, public outreach, working with the stakeholders, and research. I put this slide up here. This is a shot that I took this last winter during a Trout Unlimited film shoot on the Little Truckee River, and I thought I'd put it up because the commission had to deal with some recent reg changes on that water. And I just want to give an example. This system is working great, and it's being assessed currently for wild trout designation. I also have some complimentary movies that came about from the DVD shoot for the commissioners. So great. I'll hand those out later.
And if you could just make sure that snow shows up for this winter.
Not that snow, more snow than that.
More than that. But.
In 2006, when I took over the program, I came up with a conceptual model and a process and a phased approach to designate waters, which wasn't in place before. And it's fairly simple. It's phase one, you go out in a resource assessment phase, see what's there. Phase two is a candidate phase, at which point we've looked at the criteria and some of the attributes of these waters, and if it deemed feasible and appropriate, we move on and put more resources and staff on top of that to assess the population. We also start working with the stakeholders and get the movement for management goals and objectives started. Eventually that leads to the third phase, which is the designation phase, where we compile all that information into a management strategy and goal, and then we bring it forward to the commission. If the commission deems it appropriate and they're designated, we move to a phase four, which is our monitoring phase. And that usually goes in time intervals of 5 years where we go back and make sure everything's still fine with the population status and trend. If the commission doesn't decide and drops it from designation, then we can either do two things, just stop the process altogether or go back to the drawing board if directed by the commission to get more data or work with the stakeholders or whatever we need to do.
Roger, just a second.
Yeah.
That last picture, I got to ask where...
That's Mossbury Falls on the Upper Sac.
I'm just checking because it looked like Kauai to me, so I wasn't sure. You know,
That is incredible.
That's probably one of the most photographed spots in the entire world when it comes to flying.
If we got rid of all that info, it would be a really beautiful picture. But no,
I struggle with that too. So there's another beautiful shot. This is an example of a phase four monitoring of a designated wild trout water. Again, I put this up there because we had the commission dealing with Hawk Creek last year, and there was some interesting dialogue about that regulation change, which was my fault. I apologize. For a winter opener. At that point, we were already looking to do some monitoring to bring up and assess the population in 2007. We did an extensive electrofishing effort on multiple sections in the public water. We also did creel surveys both in 2007 and 2008. But as you can see from the slide, this is takes a lot of effort, and there's probably less than a quarter of the staff in the water, and there's over 24 people out there right there in the slide that are DFG employees. So we rely heavily on the stakeholders, volunteers, and the NGOs to help us make this happen. And that's really one of the things that I think we walked away, especially from Hawk Creek, seeing the benefits from working in a collaborative fashion. So we had not only fish and game employees out there electrofishing, but we also had four service employees, and even I think Mark Drew from Caltrout holding the bucket, which I tried to work an analogy in there someplace, but I couldn't. Needless to say, this was a successful effort both from the data standpoint and also from the collaborative standpoint and working with the local volunteers and stakeholders. The other things that...
Hang on here. You got to go back to that. I got to see that again.
The electrofishing?
Yeah, yeah. Tell me, what it's giving him ideas for a new fishing. He's going to stop using dynamite.
What is going on there?
So that's a good question. I should explain that. We're basically doing a multiple-pass depletion, and we go in with electrofishers and temporarily stun the fish, pull them out, and then actually just count the fish within a known linear section of stream. That way, when you guys hear those estimates of trout numbers, which this is some of the highest trout numbers in the nation, 10,000 trout per mile, that's how we get those numbers. So we remove the fish, count them, weigh them, and then we can get an idea and extrapolate out based on these little subsamples that we do. And it's fun, too.
Yeah, Dan, my very first job with the department in 1985 was I was on the wild trout crew. And what you see, those long poles, that's the anode, and then there's a wire with the cathode, the electric.
You keep throwing that out.
And if you fell in during that, and we did have some people that did that. It's amazing how fast they get out of the water.
Yeah.
But Roger's right. That program's been going on probably since
1971.
I think it would be appropriate for some of the commissioners, at least one that I can think of, to go on something like that. And I'm serious.
Absolutely.
I'd love to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll change
like
your view
to do
on
that
fishing.
To participate in that. That'd
absolutely.
Be a lot of fun.
I got
to
tell you, I've spent a lot of time fishing on Hot Creek, and that is one tough place. I mean, those are sophisticated fish. If you want to try and catch them on top, that's really hard. If you dredge for them, you can get them.
Electricity is an easy way to do it.
I was just wondering, John, if you appreciate the shocks that you have here in this seat now that.
This is actually giving us some ideas. But
don't ask me to compare jobs, please.
So some other things that drive our program are the mandate strategies and concerns, one of which is codified fishing game 1725 to 1728, and I'll get into a little more detail about that. The strategic trout plan is kind of an overarching framework that we feel we fit into very well and gives us direction. And obviously the Fish and Game Commission policies for wild trout, golden trout, and the overarching trout policy we work under. And then also the imperiled trout, the listed trout species, and the sensitive trout species that we try to conserve and protect and restore. A little bit more specifics in regards to the legislative changes I alluded to. In 1979, there was an SB 1982 was was enacted, and it's also referred to as the Trout and Steelhead Management Planning Act of 79. And it required the department to recommend 25 miles and one lake every year as a catch-and-release fishery. And that was back in the day when catch-and-release was first really getting some leverage, and it seemed like a really good thing at the time. Unfortunately, two things came out of that. And one of the issues that kind of muddied the waters in regards to this mandate was that, by definition under the Act, catch and release was deemed 0, 1, or 2 fish bag limits. So one of the things that that was spawned from that was a little bit of confusion, because when you think catch and release, you don't think 1 and 2 fish bag limits. So needless to say, it was confusing and sometimes even embarrassing when we went to other states and talked about our program. And it ended the anglers in itself trying to explain this. And another thing that happened over time was that we enacted, and the commission enacted, a lot of special regs that had 1 and 2 fish bag limits. So in essence, what this has turned into was a paper exercise, and that we could open up the reg book and find a 1 or 2 fish bag limit and submit those mileage and or the lake to the commission. So the true intent of the Act was kind of being lost over time. So in 2006, Senator Cogdell and Caltrout went back to the drawing board and set up SB 384, which amended that Act. And there are certain nuances and changes to that Act, but the major shift and change was the one up there, that we just changed catch and release and swapped it for wild trout. That provided a lot more clarity and direction to the department to manage based on fisheries management and not a management tool, which is, regulations. So this is actually kind of a landmark moment. We haven't designated a wild trout water in over 10 years and a lake in 10 years, and we haven't done a heritage trout designation even longer. So we believe this is a good move forward to start looking at the watershed level and wild trout management instead of just a regulatory mechanism. So what that currently leaves us with is just 2 designations for trout in the state, is wild trout and heritage trout. There's no more catch and release designations. It's not that we're giving up and abandoning these resources. We're still monitoring them, but we're just really clarifying them. And I think we'll also, the waters that had previous designations and catch and release, we're also prioritizing those to look at wild trout designation as well. So another thing that I like to point out is that as we pulled those catch and release waters that in some cases a lot of the constituents thought were wild trout, we reduced the overall mileage of these designated waters across the state. And ultimately, if you look at the total mileage up there now, 586 and plus, if you put that in perspective, I've heard upward estimates of 20,000 to 30,000 cold water stream miles. We're just scratching the surface about designating when we look at those numbers. And then we have 5 lakes up there designated, and there's probably upwards of over 5,000 to 6,000 cold water lakes that could potentially qualify. So we also have a mandate to inventory every stream and lake in the state. So we got a lot of work cut out for us based on those mandates. So that brings us to 2008 and our waters that we're bringing forth today for consideration: Upper Piru Creek in Ventura County for heritage and wild trout, and Long Lake in Plumas County for just wild trout. Quick overview of these waters. Upper Piru Creek watershed resides primarily in the Los Padres National Forest at about 7,000 to 8,000 feet. It drains a massive drainage of 187 square miles, but you need every inch because there's hardly any rain in that area, so we need a lot of water. The main stem mileage is 39 miles, but if you include the named tributaries, it bumps up the total to 80 miles. Now, we only needed to come up with 25, but I think it's important that we look at the watershed as a whole and how it functions and not do linear designations and try to get away from that. So for juxtaposition of where we are, it's the upper Piru Creek drainage is down by Los Angeles Northwest. It resides in the upper part of the Santa Clara drainage. It's actually close to Pyramid Lake. It feeds into Pyramid Lake. So if you've ever gone over on 5 over the Grapevine, you've driven right by it. It's a fairly large watershed, like I spoke about. It's seen its share of wildfires. Almost the entire watershed is burned. But it's a natural occurrence in that watershed, so it really hasn't affected the population of the fish at all. And the lifeblood has been the tributaries, and that's why I want to include those in to the designation, because that's where the major spawning and rearing habitat is. It's not your quintessential trout stream. As you can see, it's fairly arid. There's yucca plants and sandstone formation, so this isn't Hack Creek or Hawk Creek. But it is very unique for Southern California. The water temps there can get up over 80 degrees, and these trout evolve down there and can thrive. That's the main stem on the left, and then on the right is Lockwood Creek, a major spawning tributary, and that is spring-fed. So a little bit about the fishery. We've been surveying it since 1995. We've had angler surveys since 1996. It's got great catch per unit effort for anglers fishing it year-round, 2 fish per hour, which is actually pretty high. There are some lake-run fish that come up from the reservoir that can get up to 18 inches, which is kind of nice and unique for Southern California. Genetic studies indicate that it's actually a pure population. There's no hatchery alleles in there, so that's really necessitates the heritage trout designation, I think. It's a pretty unique resource. And currently it's under a special reg with a 2-fish limit, a barbless lure, year-round. This is actually, it was kind of fortuitous, I guess. I got an email from this guy yesterday. He fished Upper Pyro Creek on Wednesday of this week and caught this fish, most likely a run-up from Pyramid Lake. And you can tell it's Southern California because he's wearing a tank top. So it's actually a really unique resource, and a lot of anglers that know about it enjoy it year-round. Moving on to Long Lake in Plumas County. It's north of Sacramento in the Gold Lakes Basin, if commissioners are familiar with that area. Gold Lake is the larger lake down the right-hand corner for juxtaposition, and Long Lake is the other lake in the middle with the constriction points. And then you can see a couple islands. Maybe it's probably a little too small. It's 141 surface acres, approximately 6,000 feet in elevation. It's oligotrophic, so they're very low nutrient loads, but they still grow pretty good-sized fish in here, even though there's not a lot of nutrients. It's really aesthetic. It's a natural lake. There's not a lot of shoreline access for anglers, so primarily people that fish it from a float tube, but you can fish it from shore. It's been managed and monitored by the department since the 1960s. They pulled the allotment in 1994 because they thought it was a great candidate for just self-sustaining wild trout management. It's got both pelagic and nearshore trout available, i.e. there's fish out in the deep water and there's fish cruising around the shoreline. And that stems probably from the various stocks and strains that were historically stocked in the reservoir. Currently, it's managed under a 5-fish bag limit, no gear restrictions. And I want to make the point that that's different from the last water that we talked about. And it's that allows us the flexibility under wild trout designation to use any reg we feel appropriate. So this isn't about designating it for catch and release. This is about wild trout. So the last survey that we did was actually this year, and previous to that, 2001, both established they were self-sustaining fisheries with multiple age classes and fishes. The unique thing about this is we've got various strains and probably different species residing in the different niches in the lake. That looks to me like they probably planted golden trout in the lake at one time, and they're still maintaining in the stream and probably along the shoreline. And then also they got some fairly good-sized fish with some of their gill net sets out in the middle of the lake, and those are probably Kamloops is my guess, and historically that was a stock that they put in there. And then we got the brook trout that seems to be ubiquitous at high elevation lakes all over the Sierra Nevada. So a pretty good diversity of angling opportunities and fish for anglers that want to go up and catch these wild fish. So with that, any questions?
Thank you. Any questions?
You know, I guess I kind of missed the catch and release versus the differences that you were talking about, because it kind of came across as we don't have catch and release waters, we're designating the other. Can you explain that again?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I may have
no, that's okay.
Sped up. Yeah. And that's a really good point leading to the confusion that the anglers have had, and even within our own department.
So not just the blondes, anglers too. Okay.
When we designated previously, when the commission designated catch and release waters.
He's a smart guy. He didn't even go there. Yeah. He just kept right on going.
Good job.
He's from Humboldt.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Neil wanted me to sneak that in, and I avoided it.
Oh,
well,
no.
I was planning for the benefit of the deputy director, the director, and Commissioner Kellogg to announce that he's a Humboldt grad, but Neil just stole the thunder, you know. I mean,
I actually mentioned that earlier when we were talking about getting electrocuted and why we used Humboldt graduates versus a doctor who gave his presentation in less than 5 minutes to the commission about Peregrine. But we won't go there.
So getting back to Commissioner Gufson's question. Like I said, there was a lot of confusion in regards to what a designated water is. Now, we're not walking away from our responsibility and our current regulation and management of some of these waters, but to move forward and designate solely based on what tool we're using to manage the fishery under regs, I think was confusing and complicated, especially when we had a one or two fish bag limit under the definitions of that act. And that just really made it difficult to pass on the information to the angling constituents on what to expect. So they go to our list and they see a catch and release water, and they go and they see people with a stringer fish. That was confusing. Also, it was confusing, and I think it was the intent of the act to manage these fisheries as self-sustaining fisheries. And there's a lot of designated catch and release fisheries. I'm still to this day getting calls saying, well, those are wild trout fisheries. And I said, and they were never designated. We're moving in that direction potentially to assess that. But that's where the confusion was, and that's why we tried to clarify with that legislation. Does that answer it? Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions?
We have a suggested motion from staff.
Please do.
Fish and Game Commission hereby amends its policy on wild trout waters to add Long Lake from Plumas County and Upper Piru, Ventura County.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Any discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Unanimous? 16.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. We'll talk about field trip opportunities for commissioners. Make sure there's no holes in their waders when they're shocking. Next item.
Actually, I'm the best person to fish those sorts of waters because the school I went to, they taught us how to kill things. Oh, not make them live.
I'm not touching that. Item 16, the consideration of department annual recommendation for ceilings on reservoir access fees allowed by the commission's policy on stocking fish in waters where anglers pay access fees. Neil Manji, I'd asked 100 words or less, please. It's late.
Trust me, it will be. I'm sure everybody wants to get out of here and have a lot of other things going on today. This is the department's recommendation regarding stocking fish in waters where anglers pay access fees. At this time, the department does not recommend changing the access fee. It would have gone up 25 cents from $6.50 to $6.75 per carload, and or $1.50 to $1.55, 5 cents for individuals. Basically, the reason why the department's not recommending that we move with the California Consumer Price Index is the fact that the department needs to do a little bit more research on these lakes and reservoirs where we pay, where anglers pay access fees. A quick view going to some of these lakes showed that every one that we went to, they were exceeding what they were allowed to charge based on commission policy. So if they're going to continue to charge those rates, they should be required to come back to the commission and ask and justify why they're charging those rates. So at this particular time, the department wants to do a little bit more research, go to the individuals, see where their numbers are coming out, because they can charge extra if, in fact, they're adding more fish to the fishery. But, for example, like I said, it would be $6.50 per carload and or $1.50 per angler, not either, but just or. It ranges right now from $10 in Southern California at Diamond Valley Lake to $17 if you drive in and fish offshore at Lake Amador. So rather than allowing them to increase their price, although albeit slight amount, we want to get out to those concessionaires, talk to them, see where the dollars are going to, and make sure that we do our due diligence that the anglers are getting what they are allowed to based on our stocking of those reservoirs for free right now. So we'd like to recommend that there's no change.
Okay, there are no speaker cards.
Sonky, did you?
Yeah, thank you. Quick comment. One of our goals, as you recall, one of your policies is an annual review of commission policies. And a while back, it became a repetitive, unfocused thing, and we agreed not to do that unless there was a policy we decided needed your consideration. This is one of them because we have compliance issues. What we would like to do is let Neil's staff do a little bit more research and then maybe come back to you in either this forum or the Al Toucher Committee to talk about what we're seeing out there, some of the metrics, and decide, do we change this policy or do we start holding these people accountable? So that's kind of where we hope this will go, and I'll assume the commission's okay with that strategy.
Okay, good.
That brings us to our consent calendar. I have to clarify on item 19, receipt of department report to the Fish and Game Commission and Legislature on annual accounting of deposits into expenditures from the Fish and Game Preservation Fund. That actually has been turned into the Gov's office. It's a draft still by the department because the Gov's office hasn't approved it yet. We can still receive it. Just keep in mind that it has not been approved by the Gov's office. When we get official approval, we'll get it to the commissioners. So suggested motion for consent calendar. Well, Fish and Game Commission hereby approves its December 12th, 08 consent calendar items 17 through 19.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor? Unanimous.
Announcement of future meetings. Next month, I'm sorry, there is no meeting in January. And February, we will be in Sacramento, March in Monterey, April in Crescent City. And all of our meetings are posted on our website for 09.
Okay, do I any further comments or anything anybody want to say other than bye? All those in favor, adjourn. We stand adjourned.